Ladies and gentlemen, call the order of this organizational meeting of the Board of Supervisors of Susquehanna County. Please rise with me and join me with the Pledge of Allegiance, followed by a moment of silence.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. Well, as this is the organizational meeting for the Susquehanna County Board of Supervisors, I'd like to start out by welcoming our newest member, Ms. Patricia Eager, who's been elected to the Paul Meyer District, representing that district on the Board of Supervisors. So welcome, ma'am.
Thank you.
And let me just go through the agenda to make sure everyone understands the process here today. Because this is a new meeting of the board, we will start out with election of the chair. Then whoever the chair is elected will take the gavel and then carry on and conduct the rest of the meeting. So that will be followed by election of vice chair, adoption of the resolution about the organizational meeting, talking about when the board will meet and where and at what times, and then the regular meeting calendar, bylaws, rules, and rules of practice and procedures, and then appointment of the board members to various boards, commissions, and committees for the next 2 years. So we'll start by election of a chair. And for the members, just so you know, what I'll do is I'll call for nominations. Seconds are not required on these nominations, but anyone would like to make a nomination, I'll take those. Once I have the nominations, I'll close the nominations, and I'll call for a vote on the first nominee. If that person is selected, then that will be done. If that one isn't, then we'll go to the second nominee, and third, and so on. So are there any nominations for chair of the Board of Supervisors for 2016?
Nominate Mike Sheridan.
Mr. Sheridan's nomination has been received. Are there any other nominations?
I'd like to nominate Ms. Booker.
Okay. Mrs. Booker has been nominated for chair. Any other nominations? Very well. I'll close the nominations. We'll take a vote on the first person named Mr. Sheridan. All those in favor of Mr. Sheridan being elected as chair of the Board of Supervisors, say aye.
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 Okay.
That's three votes. All those nay?
Nay.
Okay. The 3-2. Mrs. Booker, Mr. O'Brien? Nay?
I voted aye.
Okay. So 4-1. So 4-1. Congratulations, Mr. Sheridan, is the new chair of the Board of Supervisors of the Susquehanna County.
Okay, our next item of business is the election of the vice chairman for 2016. Would someone like to make a nomination?
Nominate Trish Eager.
Trish Eager's been nominated. Is there another nomination?
I nominate Mrs. Booker.
Ms. Booker has been nominated. Are there any others? Okay, let's go. Votes for Ms. Eager for vice chair?
Aye.
Votes for Ms. Booker for vice chair?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Ms. Booker has 3. Ms. Eager, 2. So Ms. Booker will be the vice chair. Our next item is a resolution entitled Organizational Meeting of the Susquehanna County Board of Supervisors 2016. Mr. Nichols.
Sure. So a couple of things. Sorry, I got to advance some slides here. So in the organizational meeting, your resolution, if I can get to the right page. Your resolution essentially specifies when and where the meetings will be held during the next year. And it's the same schedule that you have for this year. It lists that you have a 4 o'clock meeting on the first Wednesday of the month, and you'll have 7 o'clock meeting on the third Wednesday of the month. And normally when work sessions are held, you'll generally have them at 4 p.m. before the 7 o'clock meeting on the third Wednesday of the month. Now that does not include special meetings or budget meetings during the budget season. You'll have a number of those on other nights, but your regular meetings will be at 4 o'clock and 7 o'clock as they were for this year with the work session. So that's what this this resolution entails, and the rest of it's on the screen there.
Okay. Are there any questions from the board?
No.
Discussion?
No.
Y'all good with meeting times?
Yes.
Okay, do we have a motion?
Yes.
Is there a second?
I move to adopt the resolution entitled Organizational Meeting of the Fluvanna County Board of Supervisors 2016, which designates the location, date, and time of meetings.
Is there a second?
Second.
We have a motion by Ms. Booker, a second by Mr. Weaver. All in favor?
Aye.
Chair votes aye. Motion passes 5-0. Our next item is the selection of dates for the board meetings at, is that S?
Right. So, Mr. Chair, members of the board, in this case, the same thing you've normally seen, the regular work sessions, or the regular meetings at 4 o'clock on the first Wednesday, regular meetings at 7 o'clock on the third Wednesday, work sessions at 4 o'clock preceding that 7 o'clock meeting. But one change I've recommended for this year and put in this, instead of having no meeting the second meeting in August, I would propose no meeting the second meeting in July, because our children go back to school right at the first part of August. So you'll have your regular August meetings, but you'll have from the first Wednesday of July to the first Wednesday of August off in between. In other words, you just have one meeting in the month of July rather than one meeting in the month of August. If our kids went back to school later, like after Labor Day, it'd be easier. But in this case, I think it'll better accommodate family schedules and board member schedules. So that's the only change as far as the layout for next year's meetings. So it'd be July 6th would be your 4 o'clock and 7 o'clock combined meeting. No second meeting in July, and then back to regular schedule.
You know, I was trying to think of the history of why we had August just one meeting. Mm-hmm. And I think it had something to do with church revivals.
Oh.
And that's all, I mean, August was the month. Do you remember any
something like that?
That schedule doesn't bother me. I would just miss two Wednesdays of religion.
I don't think I would be a real sinner
because I miss two church meetings. But I don't have any problem with it. But I was just thinking about why we did it that way.
Yeah, I was just considering last year we had some difficulty on timing and, mm-hmm. and vacations for staff and. For folks with kids especially.
Right.
And
This
is the proposal, but I can change to whatever.
No, I don't have a problem.
Okay, do we have a motion?
So made to approve adopt the 2016 Board of Supervisors regular meeting calendar as presented.
Do we have a second?
Second.
Mr. Weaver made the motion. Ms. Eager has had the second. All in favor?
Aye.
Motion passes 5-0. Our next item is the adoption of board bylaws and rules of practice and procedures at tab T.
So I gave you about a month ago, I gave you the draft bylaws. The only substantive changes since then are three things I've highlighted. One, you can see on the screen here, I added a very small section at the end, and I'll show you that, but just about your work on appointing citizens to boards, commissions, and committees. Here, there was nothing in your bylaws on how you did that. So if you go to, if I'll take you to the very end here, I added this section where, based on state code, all appointments to authorities, commissions, agencies, boards, or other bodies required and authorized to be made by the board shall be agreed by a majority of the members present in voting. Information on all nominees for such appointments, whether to represent the county as a whole or a particular election district, shall be included in the board package for the meeting at which the appointment will be considered. Now, that's something you adopted about a year or so ago, but it's not codified in any rules anyplace. It shall be the policy of the board as a whole to scrutinize and agree upon all appointees to represent the county in any capacity. Maybe when you ask Mr. Payne, I don't think that means it has to be a unanimous vote. It just means that the board has to have a vote.
I think that's correct.
And then finally, appointments shall generally not be made more than 45 days prior to the commencement of the term for which the appointment is made. So these are very, fairly standard, and I've checked about 20 or 30 different board bylaws and practice and procedure documents from around the Commonwealth and tried to pull out the things that made most sense. But this one just codifies the things that you've said in the past. So that's been added. And then the only other two issues that have come up is, I think you all got an email a few days ago from a citizen that asked questions about in the rules paragraph four, there's a paragraph in there that says the rules are deemed to be procedural only. The failure to strictly observe the application of the rules shall not affect the jurisdiction of the board or invalidate any action taken at the meeting that is otherwise held in conformity with law. Now, I think that's appropriate and required to make sure we have clarity, but Mr. Payne can, I think, explain that from a legal point of view.
Well, what this is designed to do really is to prevent substantial matters from being affected by technical insubstantial matters. And it's possible that there might be a conflict somewhere. For example, there, if, for example, the rules said that all motions are to be adopted by majority vote of the members present and voting, that's not sufficient by statute for some actions, particularly imposition of taxes and things like that. So you don't want to create a conflict between your rules, which are designed simply to make an orderly process, and provisions of law. So I think this is...
So you're going back to the statute then?
Well, you may. It may be, you know, maybe...
But even though it's not necessarily written down per se...
Or it may be common law or whatever it might be.
I think it really gets confusing on some of this.
Well, and this one doesn't invalidate the procedures that are in here. It says if they're superseded by law in some case, then we have to be in conformity with the law. But there is a section in here, for instance, that says certain types of votes, you have to have a majority vote of all members to be able to pass things that are tax-related or dollar-related or things like that. That's in your bylaws. But this one really doesn't invalidate the procedures. There are other sections in here that says that these rules are, your board rules are primary unless superseded by law.
Yeah.
So Robert's rules is what you follow unless this bylaws or law supersedes that.
Robert's rules are for organizational procedures, and this is just stating that the law stands, and that's pretty straightforward.
And you might not even know what it is, per se.
Well, right.
Yeah. I think it's sort of confusing, and also.
It is confusing, but it's probably never going to be an issue, it's one of those things where if it were an issue, you're better off.
Better follow the law.
Following the law is probably advisable in most cases.
Yeah.
Well, and farther down, I think it's got a prior, but it says what you follow. I can't find it now, but there's a section that says that, I'm sorry, paragraph C. All meetings and business shall be conducted in accordance with these rules, Robert's Rules of Order, newly revised, the 11th edition, and the Code of Virginia. The decision by the chair with respect to interpretation, applicability, and enforceability of these rules may be overruled by a majority vote of the members present. And then...
Is that the two vote before? Are you reading from that? In other words, in here, it used to be that two people, when the meeting comes to its end, you vote to extend a meeting, but if two people object to that, then the meeting will end. You've changed that one.
That's correct. Yeah, you've never followed that before. I mean, it's never occurred since I've been here. So,
but it's been here for years.
It's been used on occasion, only rarely, because most of the time people are anxious to get the business finished.
Well, yeah.
There have been a couple of times that I can recall where two members said, it's too late to be doing this business.
That's good.
It certainly stood the test of time.
Well, it's been there since Lynn Gardner was, because he was involved in that role.
I'm trying to think, see where this is.
And then I think there's some more confusion in,
Yeah.
I certainly would prefer to go back to the old bylaws and discuss this at a later date. That would certainly, that will be a motion that I will make when we get through discussing this.
Mr. Nichols, these rules are they're very much different than what we have had in the past. The previous rules are 5.5 pages, and I think this is, I'm not sure, 11. So there's quite a bit of change from the old ones we've used for decades. So I think Mr. Weaver's right. We should look at it more closely and then address it at a different date. And who directed this to be done?
County Administrator.
Okay.
I revise your bylaws and check them every year.
Well, you make recommendations always. Yeah.
And I reviewed about 20 or 30 different counties of bylaws and procedures and tried to make sure I included things that were most common. Definitions of certain types of things. Action of record. There was nothing in there about action of record. There was nothing in there specifically about various votes and the different reactions to those. So whatever you all choose.
I can tell you that there are lots of different permutations of what you could do. Keeping existing rules would be, there wouldn't be anything wrong with that. I think this draft Mr. Nichols has prepared is a substantial improvement. There may be individual rules that you don't like, and that's fine, but I think it's more comprehensive and it's more consistent.
And that's why I handed it out a month ago.
Right. Yeah, I mean, we can table and discuss it further, but it's been there. And
to establish bylaws today. So.
You have to do something today.
But we can re-and
well, that would be my suggestion. We use the bylaws of this last year and then discuss this when the board has some time on their hands. Then we can talk about these. Because there's other things in here that I think needs to be talked about and understood. So we have some time rather than being pressured right now to move on with this and go on. I think we need to devote some time to it.
As long as you adopt some rules, you know, some reasonable set of rules, I don't think it matters.
Right.
But and
that's what I'm saying, just adopt the bylaws.
I don't have a problem with what you're saying, Mr. Weaver, because I would, by and large, recommend these rules. You know, obviously there are some issues that need to be discussed, but they are an improvement. But if you need more time to deal with them,
I think it'd be helpful to hear what some of those concerns are. I have some concerns. I know that.
You tell me now, I'm not going to be able to do any revisions or any review or any discussion or any look at some. If you're talking about waiting 3 or 4 or 5 months, well, then fine. But if you want something researched on this, I need to know what those concerns are.
I wanted to highlight in particular the areas around the seconding of and the changing of the gavel. As we all know, that was part of what created some frustration in the last session. Mr. Payne provided some interpretation on that in terms of, you know, the purpose of the motions are not to allow for frivolous motions. This new bylaws make those a little clearer, but I also think that there was a question in terms of, you know, does a particular procedural, as you pointed out, with the legal aspects of it, work to deny a voice or not to deny a voice? So, according to Robert's Rules of Orders, there are certain methods in which that can be addressed. One is the chair can step down and hand the gavel to another person, if that person's willing to accept, which is what your bylaws have. But of course, that provides the opportunity for somebody not to accept. And I think in the sense of what is a voice of the board, and unfortunately in the situation I'm talking about, there were only 3 members present. One was recused and one wasn't here. In my reading of the rules, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, as they're stated here, Mr. Payne, that majority voice would not have been heard in that particular in this particular case, based on the new rules. And to highlight that the change has been recognized as having been in the favor and in the benefit of the county. And so under these new rules, we wouldn't actually be able to have had that benefit, potentially. So I wanted to get your interpretation on the changes around those sections to those rules.
That particular matter, I think, is addressed on page 13, or page 11.
On 33, you're talking about, you know, to me, there's something something wrong there. And that's the reason that I really want to go, you know, that is going to be the motion that we take up the bylaw, the rules and practices of last year, the bylaws, and then discuss these at a later date.
Let me.
Yeah, I'd like if you address my question.
Let me make a couple of comments on this. The issue of seconds is more complicated in terms and more extensive in terms of authority in Robert's rules. And one of the things that Robert says is that it's common and permissible not to require a second in the case of a small body. So in other words, if you've got, you know, you got Congress and you got 500 people, you need a second, so you can't have one person just monopolizing the business of the entity. If you've got five people, or in the case you cited where you had one member absent, one member ill, you have three members, you really don't have to worry about that, because there's going to be a limit on the number of frivolous motions. So at one end, don't require seconds at all. The other end, require seconds under all circumstances with no exceptions. And there are various ways to various permutations of that. I'm looking must be on the next page. Yeah, they're right there. This I that's shown here is being struck through. This expresses the opinion that I gave based on Robert's rules.
That was not in our packet that was struck out. So this was recently struck out.
The black paragraph is in your current version. I recommend taking that out. The red was Mr. Payne would add to that if it stayed. And the reason I say take it out is because in the very next section it says that a tie vote fails and the board does not designate a tiebreaker. That's based on the votes.
So anyway,
these are on motions up here. The other one's on votes.
So anyway, I think you've got three. It's a practical matter. You've got three options. One is don't require seconds at all, or don't require seconds in the event there's only a bare majority of the board voting, or something, or there's a reduced number of votes. That'd be one. The second one is simply to say if there is no second, the vote fails, the motion fails, period. And the third is to use this black and red language that would allow if the matter is voted on, it does, and there's no second, it does not invalidate the vote. Those are what I see as the three options. By the way, one thing that was unusual about that vote that you were discussing, where you had the three members there, is that the vice chairman wasn't present. Mm-hmm. If the vice chairman had been present, the chairman could relinquish the chair and it would automatically be assumed by this.
Well, that was going to the second part of it, because my point is that the second part here lists that the vice chair may accept, not shall accept, using the languages, right? Or another citizen may accept, or you know, not accept from that standpoint.
Well, I think if there is a vice chairman, and of course, historically we have had a vice chairman. Mm-hmm. Vice chairman serves in the absence of service by the chairman.
Mm-hmm.
So,
but it more or less implied that the vice chair did not have to accept it, or that another member did not have to accept
it. That's not the way.
Yes, in that paragraph it does.
Yeah, but that's not the way I understand it. I think that would.
No, and that's my point, is that it would seem that the purpose of the rules are not to deny a will of a board, whether it's a complete board or an incomplete board at that point in time. You have to vote, and you have to take that vote at that point in time based on the circumstances that are presented to you. So, to me, the procedural aspect of not taking the gavel, which would be an acceptable way for the chair to speak her voice or the chairman to speak his voice, would be okay, but it has to be accepted. If it's not accepted, then it denies the voice of that chairperson when you don't have the ability to have a vote without a second and call the vote directly, which is what happened in that particular case. I think it was the in, you know, correct way, and it, I think it was in the benefit of the county in that particular example, but that's just one example, and, you know, hopefully those situations are very rare. But should those situations come up, I think it is important that the voice of the majority of the board that is present is able to speak, and that is not circumvented by procedural rules.
But anyway, the three options that I gave you with respect to seconds, the way Mr. Nichols has presented it, it would make the requirement of a second absolute. Mm-hmm. You could not lawfully hold a vote
right.
without a second. If you include that struck out language, it would require a vote, but it wouldn't invalidate, it would not
did
be
you,
fatal to a vote
that
was taken without a second.
If you include that.
If you include that.
Include the struck out portion, right?
Right.
Right. And or if you modify the ability of a person who, presumably you're turning over the gavel to the person who's in opposition of the motion being made in a three, you know, in a situation where you have three members present, right? Because presumably the only reason that's happening is that person is unwilling to vote for the motion or second the motion. So one way or another, with a board of three people, or in a situation where you have a quorum and it's three people, then that those rules apply. If we had seven people on the board, then those rules wouldn't work out in that way. Which is, my point being is that the will of the board should be heard and the procedure shouldn't be made to deny a chairperson who is responsible for the organizational part of running the meeting from being able to voice their opinion.
Mr. Chair,
can
we hear all of the concerns that we have on this so that we can, because this is the first time we've had opportunity
to discuss it.
Yes, ma'am. So if we could get all the concerns out and then have it come back to us. And
yeah.
when it comes back
that's
to
why
us,
I asked Mr. O'Brien
we have
a second
the,
ago.
Right, that we have the old one and the one we've been working on it for a long time. And
yes, ma'am.
Maybe in red those things that are changed or that are different. I don't know.
Yes, ma'am.
Well, the reason I didn't do a red line is because the new one is completely restructured and reorganized.
Yeah.
It includes the definition of all those things that weren't defined
right,
before.
But,
so
yeah,
it's just
it would almost
you
all be
restructured.
Red.
Oh,
well, I agree that the
yeah,
new.
It's completely different.
I agree that the new rules are better and more comprehensive, but that one particular. And,
sure.
and you address that in part mm-hmm. because of what occurred, but
right.
my viewpoint is that it is part of. The procedural part that denies a second voice from being heard when it is a chairperson is not a particularly
Robert's rules for small boards and committees and commissions, generally 12 or less is the way they use the language, does not require a second. Not just in those exceptions, but does not require a second. That does not mean you have to follow that. If you want to have motions with seconds, this was contemplated in that way, but if you want to have it, you just build it in your bylaws because this supersedes Robert's unless it's superseded by state law
right.
or by law. But in this case, we can go either whichever direction you want.
Okay. All righty. Is there any more discussion?
Well, also,
yes, sir.
You want to talk about some things.
If you'll just point out paragraphs, I'll highlight them here. That way I can research them and get information back to all of you.
What page?
Like E,
page 34. 34.
It's at the top of the page. A maker of a motion may not speak against
his
motion.
Yeah, I like that. I think it's disingenuous to make a motion that you don't support.
We had that happen once.
Yeah.
We've had it happen many times, as a matter of fact.
But you talking about freedom of speech, then you want discussion on the board. But that's all right to disagree. I think that it's all right where it is.
I think that's extremely disingenuous and unprofessional, and I like that addition in there.
I did too.
That's straight out of Roberts.
Yeah,
that's
like,
straight out of Roberts.
Yeah.
It can be stricken, but
that's embarrassing when somebody makes a motion that
votes
against
it.
Okay.
Against it.
Right. That's just
anything else, Mr. Weaver?
Of the system.
Huh? Anything else?
No, except where we're talking about the one vote, and then it gets to where the chair doesn't have anyone to give the gavel to. So what do you do then? There is no chair.
There's no vice chair.
There's no vice chair. You want to give it to one of the other individuals, like when there was only three people there, he gave it to me and I refused it. So there was no chair there to approve that motion. I mean, it's really confusing where you are in that whole thing.
You could, Mr. Weaver, to that point, this is what this paragraph specifically says that the chair can chair should routinely refrain from making or seconding motions, and that's all through Roberts, only because the chair is presiding. It's supposed to be impartial. But it's contemplated what you all talked about before. In any case, the chair shall not make motions or second a motion without first temporarily surrendering the chair to the vice chair, if present and willing, or to another person willing to temporarily accept the gavel. Now, if you want it to that be taken out, the chair can turn over the gavel anytime, and mm-hmm. someone has to take it, or the chair can turn over the gavel anytime someone is willing to take it. It can be either way, but that's what I was contemplating, what you talked about based on your meetings prior. I mean, I think that's the question right there.
Yeah. If you're concerned about making sure that you don't have a situation where the chairman would either make a motion or second the motion, but can't because he's sitting in the chair, and you don't want to have that happen, the obvious way to do it wouldn't take care of all the instances, but require that the vice chairman assume the chair at that point until the
member being relinquished to assumes it, which is the second line.
That's the second line. That's a little bit different, and the reason I say that is because that would certainly take care of all the cases, but the reason that's different is the vice chairman has assumed the role of acting as chairman. The other member may not have mm-hmm. and may not want to serve as chair.
Sure. And that is, in fact, what Mr. Weaver did, is he didn't assume the chair.
No, that's correct.
So, and that was his prerogative, and that's fine.
That's correct. And I'm not saying that would have served that case, but in the event that, let's say, have been three members, including the chairman, the vice chairman, and one other member, the vice chairman wouldn't have had the discretion not
to
accept
to take
it.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Okay. So should the
chairman... So now we know some of the things we still have to discuss. I think we've talked about all the sticking points right now.
Are there any others?
Ms. Hager?
I'd like to come back to this. I'd like to adopt the rules that we have in the past. And you give the previous rules so that we can compare them. I don't think they had the benefit of that. I happen to have it because of you gave it to me and the orientation package. Mm-hmm. I think it would be really helpful for the other members.
We could pull it up. We can get that done. Yeah.
Okay, well then,
do
we have a motion?
We're just tabling this.
We still have to adopt the previous.
We'll have to adopt the current.
Just I move to readopt the 2015. Mm-hmm. So on the screen.
I move to readopt the bylaws of 15.
Is there a second?
Second.
We have a motion made by Mr. Weaver, seconded by Ms. Seeger. Those in favor?
Aye.
That's 5-0. Chair votes aye as well.
You do not have to change anything. In years past, there have been times when you didn't change anything from year to year, and the bylaws simply continued from year to year.
Yes, sir.
You could do that. I just want to alert you to the proposition that this isn't going to happen automatically. What you've done is now adopted them for the year, subject to your changing. Mm-hmm. So if we choose to
at a later date, we can come back to
you
it
can revisit
and,
them
and revisit
anytime
them.
You want, but you have to make
a permanent
revisit.
Okay.
I will not do it then.
Okay. Our next item is the Board of Supervisors appointments to boards and commissions at tab U.
So in front of you, I'll pull it up on the screen, but in front of you, you've got a hard copy of the listing. I want to point out two things. The yellow block are positions for the chair. So whoever's selected chair, Mr. Sheridan, would be normally appointed to those three things. And you could change the emergency services director, because that can be the county administrator or another board member, either way. And you could change the VACO contact, which can't change the finance board by state code.
Okay.
And then the other thing is on the bottom. I've added on there the Fluvanna Partnership for Asian, because they're becoming more active and meeting on a regular basis. It's every other month. But I wondered if maybe the board would want a board member selected to serve, to attend those meetings in a capacity like you do for some of the other boards and commissions. But anyway, those are the listing. And then out to the right on your sheet, you'll see the
previous 2 years and the 2 years prior to that on who served in those various positions. So I'll just follow whatever you say and I'll fill them in and then we'll have it here.
Mr. Nichols?
Ma'am.
By law, how many of these committees are necessary to be have a board member on them?
In these cases, these are the ones that the board has either set policy for or policies on the bylaws of that organization that require elected officials.
So they either require it by their bylaws or...
Well, for instance, the Thomas Chesterton Planning District Commission, we're a signatory on that charter and the bylaws for the Thomas Chesterton Planning District Commission. It requires a certain number of elected officials from the participating bodies. The Planning Commission requires by our code a board supervisor member as a representative to the Planning Commission. The Social Services Board requires a board member representative.
Ravenna River Basin.
I'd have to go check the Ravenna River Basin Commission bylaws, but I think it requires two elected officials from participating bodies. Mm-hmm. So in all these cases, there are either ones you've set by policy in the past, the board has, that we have in policy, the board member needs to be a representative, or they're in the core bylaws of the organization, and we're a signatory on that organization's bylaws.
Or there are some cases where it's either set by state law or the county code.
Like the finance board.
Now, the Youth Advisory Council, isn't that the board recommended?
That was a board directed one. It's just been convention for the number of years they've been established. I don't know of any of these that you could say you could go away with. I'd have to research the Ag and Forestal Board, or Forestal Committee. I don't know that that's met in forever, but I believe it requires a board representative, but I can check those too.
We have many talented people in the community who would welcome a chance to serve, so that's why I asked that question.
Well, I can give you an example. On Ag and Forestal Board, you have many talented citizens that are already on that one, but the board is another representative. The Audit Committee is an internal function. The Columbia Task Force is a board set up, and it was board recommended that a board member sit on that. The CPMT requires a board member. Emergency Services Director can be myself, can be a board member, can be the chair. The Finance Board is required to be the chair. The Fort Union Sanitary District Advisory Committee, I'm not sure. Mr. Stevens, do you know offhand in the bylaws, does it say a supervisor? Or is it just been, I know it's been convention, but is it saying their bylaws for FUSBI offhand?
I think there might be.
Well, I'll mark that one just
it's
in case.
It's a non-voting position.
But that's always an important position.
That's an important position.
For that district, I would not in other words, like you.
Right. Yeah. I would not want to not serve on that one.
Parks and Rec Advisory Board, again, these are liaisons back to this board. Mm-hmm. And that's why the board member's always been on there. The Workforce Investment Council requires, Planning Commission requires, Ravenna River Basin Commission, I believe, requires two elected officials. Social Services Board is required.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure about the Criminal Justice Board, but I expect that probably is a board member, but I'll mark that one and research it. TJPDC requires a certain percentage of elected officials. We have one elected official, one citizen as our representatives. VACO requires just an elected official, so it could be any one of you. It doesn't have to be the chair, but it's been by convention the chair in the past. And then YAC was a local request. And Fluvanna Partnership for Aging doesn't list a supervisor. I'm just suggesting you may want to be, because I think it's an important issue for our county because of the aging of America, and it's a more active committee. So
is someone aging?
Yeah. Yeah. And the other thing is, when you're sitting on these boards, you learn a lot about what they do, who they're serving, how they spend their funds, because they come before us for financing. And it's good to have a board member sitting here that's familiar with that particular organization. I sit on the Interagency Council, not because I have to, but I sit on it because every agency that serves Fluvanna, Louisa, a lot of them are regional, I get to see what they're doing, I get to see how they're serving our people and I do that just on my own, because when we get to discussing that, I feel like I can have some input, and I have a relationship with those directors and those people that serve our community.
The other thing, Ms. Eager, is that 3 years ago, or 3.5 years ago, I extensively researched all boards, commissions, and committees for need, actual meet, have they been meeting, you know, what the purpose was and what the membership was, and the board eliminated about 6 different boards, commissions, and committees at that time that were deemed to be unnecessary, not required, or hadn't been meeting. And the only one that's come back since then, well, a couple of them came back immediately because there was a different state law looked at it differently and from what we had found, but the only one that came back formally since then was the finance board, because the board of supervisors requested that it be reconstituted. It's not required by state code, but if you have it by state code, you have to, I mean, if you have it, then you have to follow a specific state code. The chair, a citizen, and the treasurer.
Alrighty. So are we going to go down each one?
Now, just one reminder, if you're going to sign up for one, especially some of these more important ones, that please, please, please try to sign up for ones that you can actually make an attendance.
Right.
Because we've
had... Well, that's something I'm going to bring up. Like the Parks and Rec, when I have practice, I can't be there. Right. So I would not mind having input with them. And Mr. Smith with Parks and Rec. I just was unable to attend meetings when I was coaching football and baseball.
But you want to stay on that, right?
If somebody else would like to be on there that could be there more often, I will still consult with them.
But you're a good one if you can get there, because you're involved with
it. It's just really tough for me.
The population.
Yes, sir. But that's what I'm saying. I don't mind contacting them and being in touch if somebody else would like to be on that can be there at 4:30.
I would suggest that if a board member is not going to be at the function, schedules are
fast. That's what I'm saying.
The board member is not going to be there. You either decide to not have a board member as part of it, or you select another board member.
Mr. Weaver, Agricultural and Forestry Advisory.
Yeah, those top two are fine.
You want to stay with those?
Yes.
Columbia Task Force, are we still going to continue to meet?
We will meet again, but not until the FEMA grant final is approved, and then we'll reconstitute
again. Then I will stay with that one.
Okay. And we'll have to probably look at the time, because 1:30 Friday is probably not going to be very good for you.
Well, that's actually better, as long as it's before 3:45.
Okay.
As long as I can get there and get out.
Okay. And we can put the meetings at the 4:00.
Ms. Booker, the CPMT, ma'am?
Yeah, that's fine.
And with the emergency services chair, is that talking about going to the Monday night meetings?
No. This is emergency service, not fire, rescue.
So
this is disaster prep and things like that. Emergency services coordinator is the one who does things day to day.
Correct.
Reports to the county administrator. But if we have an actual natural disaster or earthquake, then in the past, counties have used county administrators, board members, or chairs. We've never used it here.
I'm probably going to be out there somewhere.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that means you can't be the emergency service director if you're going to be on the scene.
Then I probably shouldn't be that person.
So maybe our county administrator ought to be.
County administrator, y'all okay with that? Are you okay with that?
Yes, and I think that's frankly more appropriate, just because closer to the day to day.
But
I still have to get permissions for certain kind of things from the
board. I will be in contact with you. Okay. It'll be easy for us to get in touch.
Indeed.
All right, finance is me. Ms. Booker?
Yes, definitely.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Is there anyone who can make a 4:30 on Tuesday afternoon meeting for Parks and Rec?
I could sign up for every last one I'm on here, probably.
I know you would.
Yeah, you're good at that.
I will go when I can.
Just
the time.
I can stay on it. I'll go when I can.
But vice chair, maybe if you can't go, you call me.
I'll let you know.
Okay.
Between the two of us, we'll hopefully get one of us there. Keep reminding me, young man.
Primary and alternate. Yes, you could appoint Mr. Sheridan as the member with Mrs. Booker as an alternate if you want.
That sounds like a winner. All right, Piedmont Workforce, Mr. O'Brien.
Yeah, I'm fine with that.
Planning Commission.
I'd like to do that.
Mr., I was going to ask between the two of y'all.
Yeah, that would be planning. You've been on it.
Well, I'm wondering whether Tony wants to be down there on that Thomas Jefferson Planning District Commission. I had volunteered before, and I don't mind, you know, you're there and everything.
You like but, doing that, too.
But I would have volunteered for that one. But if you like it, that suits me fine.
Well, it's convenient because it's in town and I'm there, so I like doing that one.
And Trish has experience.
She has experience on the Planning Commission. I mean, I think it's...
That's one of the reasons I would recommend her not doing it.
Yeah.
Every time you select something you're most familiar with, you're not helping the board improve and you're not helping
that'd
the
be
knowledge.
My only cause. I mean, I think she has lots of experience.
I would always kind of try to get you more broadened.
It's been a good experience, for sure.
I don't want to overload you, though.
No, I mean, I don't want to take more than what I currently have, for sure.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's come back to that one, the Planning Commission.
A lot of, like, the TRC meetings are hard for me to make, and, you know, those kinds of things. So maybe it's a shared, if we can do that one shared, it would be nice.
The TRC, you can't do
it.
You're not required to attend the TRCs anyway.
I can't be at the TRC.
No, you can't. You can't have an alternate appointment because it's defined by the county code.
Okay. All righty. Rivanna River Basin.
I have been Allenbrook and Moselle Booker for a couple of years, and that meant that I had to go to all executive meetings. They don't have a whole lot of meetings, and I think that the state says should be two board of supervisors, so I don't mind staying on it, but I would certainly like to have another board, and they meet in town. But they meet at 10:30 sometimes, and it's not every month.
It's got written down 12 p.m. on the second Monday.
And I just checked it yesterday, and it's shown second Mondays at 12 generally monthly. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they miss a month.
Okay. Right.
Sometimes they may put out that they skip one.
Yeah.
Anybody willing to step into that one?
I'll stay on it, but
yes,
we need to have...
I've already put a check mark beside
you, Ms. Parker. But we haven't done the... Two board members, though.
You have or have not?
We have not, and it's required.
We've always had two, but only one has ever attended.
Right.
Oh, okay. Well, then I will attend.
Okay.
Ms. Egan.
All right.
Thank you,
ma'am. And we can travel together.
Okay. All righty. Coming down to Social Services Board, then Mr. Ellenbrook.
I'll do that.
You'll do that one? Thank you, ma'am. Thomas Jefferson Area Community Criminal Justice Board. Holy cow.
Didn't Mr. Ellenbrook?
Mr. Ellenbrook has been there.
Yeah, he has.
Is that the one we decided to let him be the citizen on? No, that's a jail board.
That's a jail board. Yeah. In fact, we don't even have that on here.
The jail authority is not on there because it's not required by a board of supervisor member. So anything that doesn't require a board member is just on the long list.
Okay.
But board members sometimes may be appointed to those.
Okay. Yeah, how we thought it was.
Like the
Water Authority. And that's a quarterly meeting?
So when does this criminal justice board meet?
Theoretically quarterly, but I'm not sure that they've had any meetings that I've heard of since I've been here. I don't think Mr.
Me
Kenny
either.
Attended, and Mm-mm. I'm pretty sure Mr. Ellenbrook didn't, but I'd like to at least get a name and then I can follow up with him, but I'm not sure that they actually meet.
I'm not much good at criminal justice board, I don't think. I would rather have been on something else.
Maybe one of our other constitutional officers that used to be on the board now?
Mr. Chair, Mike.
Yes, sir.
The reason a board member got appointed to that, we used to have a citizen member, had an ex-woman that was a retired law enforcement officer who worked in Richmond, a friend of mine. And when he decided to step down for health reasons, he asked me if I might be interested. I worked with DCJS at the time in Richmond. And I think we picked up the habit of having a board member because I had the time.
Because you accepted it then.
It could, I believe, easily be a citizen member unless they change their bylaws, and retired police officer or law enforcement person might be an ideal candidate.
Okay, so I could.
Just a little background on it. I think it just occurred by virtue of, I think his name is second, he passed away, which had a problem. That's why we have a board member.
Okay.
Well, I'll cut that down here, research it, and then if it can be a citizen, I'll bring it back to the nominations.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
All righty.
PDC.
Yeah, I'd like to stand that.
Okay.
Mr. O'Brien. The VACO. How often does that meet, Ms. Booker? Just, you're talking about just the commission?
It doesn't. Yeah. It's just a contact.
No. Yeah.
Okay. It's really just contact.
It's just contact. You ought to do... I thought you wanted to do legislative stuff.
there's not much they ask of you, and it only comes to my office.
That sounds good. That'll stay as me. All right. The Youth Advisory Council, Ms. Booker?
Yes.
And that brings us back. The only one left is the Planning Committee. Well, hang on. Excuse me. Would anybody be interested in the Partnership for Aging?
And how often they meet? Fourth Monday.
Yeah, it's on fourth Monday at the library, and it's every other month, odd-numbered months.
Yeah, I would like to do that because I'm on the JABA board, and that way...
They go hand in hand?
I can keep...
Now, and again, that's not required. In the bylaws, it lists the county administrator or designated representative, and I generally still go, but I have other staff members that go. But because they're doing more, because there's a lot of senior issues for any locality, it might be good to have a direct link to the board.
And I want to look out for Don and myself.
Yes, look out for us.
Senior citizens.
Keep me going.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
I got ready to say ageless when y'all started talking about that age thing. Yes. We got the two ageless wonders here.
Yes.
Do you have a summary board for the ageless? We appoint Mr. Weaver.
Absolutely.
Planning Commission.
Planning Commission.
Yeah, I really would like to stay on it. And next year I'll relinquish it.
Okay.
Okay.
These are two-year appointments, although you can change them, but these are normally 2 years.
We can change them if we need to.
Okay, O'Brien's going to stay.
O'Brien's going to stay.
Okay.
It's going to be busy.
Okay, so that takes care of...
Let me just minimize this so you can kind of see it. I know that's hard to see, but you can see Weaver on two, Sheridan on
four,
Booker on one, two, three, four, five... O'Brien on one, two, three. And some of these are much more meaty because they meet on a very frequent basis. They're important meetings. Right. They have a lot of, some of them are more advisory. And if you didn't make every meeting, it wouldn't be particularly problematic. But especially Planning Commission, TJPDC, Piedmont Workforce Investment Council, Parks and Rec, those kinds of things really need some
guidance. And social services.
And social services is essential.
Mm-hmm. Sure is.
So I've got your list here, and I'll come back with information on the Community Criminal Justice Board on whether it can be a citizen.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So those are the names, and we'll just need your vote on those. There's the motion.
All righty. Do we have a motion?
Mr. Chairman, I move to make the following supervisors' appointments to various boards and commissions for terms effective January 1st, 2016 through December 31st, 2017, as discussed.
Do I have a second?
Second.
Motion made by Mr. Weaver, seconded by Ms. Booker. All in favor?
Aye.
And the chair votes aye. Motion passes 5-0. Now I got to find the correct page.
It should be inside.
Regular meeting script.
Way towards the front.
We will now reconvene the regular meeting of the Fluvanna County Board of Supervisors to order. I call the regular meeting of the Fluvanna County Board of Supervisors to order. We will begin.
Just go down to adoption of the agenda, sir.
Adoption.
Now we'll adopt the agenda for the meeting. Are there any recommended changes or other updates?
I move that we adopt the agenda for January 6, 2016.
Do we have a second? We have a motion by Ms. Booker, second by Mr. Weaver. All in favor?
Aye.
Chair votes aye. It passes 5-0. Now we'll hear the county administrator's report.
Mr. Chair, just a couple of brief things since we have a lot to cover. A citizen appointment, and I'll get you you can tell me what you want to do. Thomas Jefferson Planning District Commission created a new Rural Transportation Advisory Council. Now, we already have a staff member that's part of the kind of the rural committee, but there's this new one called Rural Transportation Advisory Council. And they recommended it could be one of the two TJPDC representatives that we have already, could be another elected official or a Planning Commission member. But Mr. Boyles went on to say it could be a citizen, anyone you want, but those are the recommended one of those.
So it's an advisory council that's similar to the Metropolitan Planning Organization that looks at regional transportation issues, but we're not part of the MPO. But in this case, this would meet quarterly, discuss projects, and look at rural transportation information. And then they'll probably meet starting in March, so you've got some time, or you could appoint one of the two TJPDC or Planning Commission members tonight as you choose. But this is the information that came in from TJPDC, a new request.
Okay, now, so we don't have to do anything tonight?
Well, if you're of a mind to just say that one of the two TJPDC members, if you're leaning that way, then I will just bring back at your next meeting just an appointment. If you want to do it as one of the Planning Commission members, I can poll them and check with them too. If you want it just to be open up to anybody, then I'll have to put the word out in the street and get some candidates and things. But I think in this case, because Rural Transportation Advisory Council really needs to have a tie to what we do as what you do as a board or what the Planning Commission does, tied to staff, I think it would be useful to use either the TJPDC rep or a Planning Commission member, but it's your choice.
How do they communicate with VACO Transportation Steering Committee?
I don't know, ma'am.
VACO's
an advisory body.
Okay.
The TJPDC makes recommendations and then go into VACO too for legislation and for traffic information, but I don't know that there's a direct link that they coordinate. Mm-hmm. VACO is an independent body.
Either myself or Steve can stay on, or Mrs. Eager wants to do that one. You can do that if you want to get on that board. I mean, it's before the meeting, so it's easy enough for me to do that one.
Before the TJ?
PDC meeting, yeah.
Okay. You're already there.
I'm already there, yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm already there, so.
Somebody's caught.
And the other thing you could do is Mr. Popowitz handles most of our VDOT issues, and so you could use Mr. Popowitz as your community development director with transportation issues as well.
Wouldn't hurt for him to show up. That's true, too.
He coordinates with most of our VDOT things for mm-hmm. me. So.
Yeah.
And it would save you money because you don't have to pay anybody. Mileage or things like that. We'll give them a car.
just cover the gas.
Do we have to make motions on that?
I will come back with a formal appointment on the next meeting. If you agree with Mr. Popowitz at doing that, then we'll just designate as a community development director and list him there. I think we have another staff member from the planning department that goes to a separate rural caucus. So.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And then the second item, just to remind you, you've got your leadership planning retreat on Saturday, the 23rd. I'll have a draft agenda out to you, I think on Friday this week. And then once I get feedback from you, I'll have your package out to you about a week or 10 days before the meeting, because there'll be a significant amount of financial charts and comparisons and debt summaries and things like that, so that you'll have it to review before you have the offsite on that Saturday.
And it'll be in the Morris room?
No, Fork Union Community Center.
I didn't read that.
The community center at Fork Union.
Oh, okay.
In that big room there. So we'll have enough room for the board, and then a similar setup to do in the library 2 years ago with the board, and then
Is it stopped? Anybody that wants to come to watch. Okay.
And that's all I have.
Now,
just a reminder, your next meeting is the 20th. Mm-hmm. We'll try to keep your agenda very light, because you've got a joint public hearing that night on the two mm-hmm. water SUPs, if those go forward, and that will be with the Planning Commission at your 7 o'clock meeting. So anything else on the agenda, I'll try to keep very light, because those will take some time, of course. Any questions I can answer for the board?
Anyone? Okay. Now we'll hear updates from each supervisor regarding any meetings that you have attended. Anyone? Mr. O'Brien?
LMOA board meeting. I went to the board meeting to report on water issues, as well as the change in the polling place for the Ravenna district.
Okay.
Basic meeting. Nothing fancy. Most of the other meetings were not held this period.
Ms. Booker?
I attended the Youth Advisory Council meeting Monday evening. Got there a little late, but was able to have a nice conversation with Dr. Myers, who is our CSA director, and with Parks and Recreation, with our librarian, and Ms. Daly, who is associate worker for Fluvanna County, and our terrific Tuesdays, going well. We have about 150 students participating, and we were looking to try to consider going down in the future to maybe Carers Brook with the third and fourth graders. But that's really, you know, going nicely with these after-school programs for our middle school children.
And it's been so nice to see volunteers from the community.
Lots of
stepping
volunteers,
forward,
yeah.
See a lot of the young people that I know the fire department was, a bunch of the young guys were having trucks coming in there and doing fire safety and things of that nature. I would like to thank Mr. Payne for organizing the hunt out at Pleasant Grove. Had several volunteers show up. They had, was it six hunters?
Six guns, yes.
Had six hunters showed up and...
Supposed to be seven. One turned up sick that day.
Were they handicapped? Did you have
all of them were wheelchair.
All of them, okay.
All of them. And
that's
go ahead, Mr. Payne, you talk about it.
It was very much like it has been in the past. The last year we, instead of doing it all day, we only did it in the afternoon, and we did the same thing this time. And the reason we did that is, based on our experience, the critters seemed to come out in the afternoon better at Pleasant Grove. And we didn't have much of a harvest in the morning, so it seemed to make sense to do that. It made sense this time because we got all the guns in their positions by 2 o'clock, and nothing happened much till about a quarter after 4, and we started getting some action at that point. The last shot was right around 5:30, which was about as late as you could do it. We got a total of 6 animals. 5 of them were does. And of course, we're trying to shoot as many does as possible. One of them was obviously a mature doe, probably, I would guess, 3 years old. The others were varying grades of little bitty ones, except for one, and that was, we got the first buck we'd ever killed. He appeared probably to be a year and a half, maybe 2.5-year-old buck.
Second year buck.
With a small 6-point rack. And if you believe in quality deer management, he was a good one to take out of the gene pool because he had funny looking antlers.
I know that I'd like to thank Sheriff Hess for coming and stopping traffic, coming down into Pleasant Grove that day. He volunteered that day and sat up there and blocked traffic. Jason, one thing I will add is we need to make a note. We probably need to station somebody at the dog park or at the sheriff's department.
Yeah, that was the only...
That was the only hiccup we had.
The only hiccup we had, somebody come in walking dogs, walked right by one of the hunters.
Walked right by the hunters. Of course, it didn't have a whole lot of effect because the deer are so used to them coming out that 5 minutes later, the deer was standing
right,
there.
Yeah. Well, the biggest problem is not that.
And safety.
Safety. There was a representative there from Parks and Rec who was all over the place.
He did a great job. Thank Jonathan.
Mr. Sheridan was there with his son.
We had 3 young men, 4 young men.
We had 3 other boys, and I can't remember his name, the other fellow, that gentleman.
Jerry.
Jerry, the grown man.
He's on the Parks and Rec Advisory Committee. Jerry Custer.
Mr. Foote.
Yeah. And he came with his 2 boys. I had mine. So we had 3 14-year-olds that were more than willing to help out.
And we had my godson, who's my partner's son, who's a sophomore at JMU. And I will tell you that he was really important because
Absolutely.
He has 20-year-old eyes instead of 65-year-old eyes. And he found, in one case, found a blood trail that nobody had found. The other one he picked up. He found a deer.
We were all 3 down in the woods looking for it. He saw it about as far from here as Sheriff Hess through the woods. And I looked over his shoulder.
The biggest item of the day was I didn't have to end up field dressing any of them.
Those young guys, his godson volunteered whether they wanted to or not. But they did a great job, so I want to commend all of them.
It was very successful.
It was very successful, and all of them, the only issue was we locked the keys in the car, but that was our fault.
A communication problem.
We had a couple of communication hiccups right there. We will now open our first round of public comment. Anyone that would like to come up? You have 5 minutes to speak.
You know this guy.
And no, we are not at church. So you have 5 minutes. Start the clock.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mel Sheridan. Just following up on a smaller issue. One of the previous issues, a DCJS board member. I remember the gentleman's name was Marty Mate, and Marty was retired military, but he's also a law enforcement professional. I mentioned it to Mr. Hazer, and unfortunately he just left, but he offered, and that's why I'm just mentioning to y'all, that if the it's the board's pleasure, he would be happy to serve in that role representing the board if that's what the board wants to do. So since he had left the room and y'all had moved on, I just wanted to mention that Jeff had said, well, he'd be certainly willing at the board's pleasure. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Somebody mark that on the calendar. Is there anyone else? In that case, I'll end the first round of public comment. Next item on the tab.
Public hearings at 7.
All righty.
Number six.
We have public hearing 7 p.m. At 7 p.m. there'll be a public hearing. Now, next, we'll move on to the action matters. Or any questions from your board about the public hearing?
No.
Okay. Action matters. B, appointment to Planning Commission. Mr. Nichols?
Yes, sir. We've got three applicants for the Planning Commission seat vacated by Mrs. Eager, Mr. Brian Gardner, Mr. Lago Maracino, and Mr. Brian Miller. And their applications have been included in your package to fill the Palmyra District seat on the Planning Commission.
Okay. Any comments?
No, any of them myself personally. They all seem to be
strong
candidates. So.
They look good. All of them look good.
They're all very strong candidates. I would like to nominate Howard Lago Maracino.
And I second it.
We have a motion made by Ms. Eager, seconded by Mr. Weaver. Any discussion? All righty. All in favor?
Aye.
And the chair votes aye. 5-0.
So just a reminder, that's a 6-month appointment. It'll be coming back to you in May for appointments because this is just to finish off Mrs. Eager's term. Uh-huh. And so then it'll come back to you. Now, reminder though, that a Planning Commission member has to go to training. And so we either want to kind of, well, it doesn't really matter. I mean, but if we send somebody to training, and then you may want to think about reappointing or delay the training until after your vote in for the June.
And he's aware he has to go to training.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Okay.
While we're on the subject, just a little bit off the agenda, but since we're talking about Mrs. Eager's successors, there will be a necessity for the court to appoint a successor to the BZA.
And we've got a list of candidates for that. I think it's on your next agenda for... I think Mr. Zimmer from the Planning Commission has volunteered for that one.
Okay.
Just a reminder.
All righty. W, appointment to the Thomas Jefferson Water Resources Protection Foundation, Mr. Nichols.
So we have two members that are elected to the Thomas Jefferson Soil and Water Conservation District, and then one appointed member, and Mr. John Easter happens to fill that, but also he's been serving as the Thomas Jefferson Water Resources Protection Foundation member. And he's the applicant you have and wishes to be reappointed.
Okay.
Any question, board?
I
have a motion.
All right. I move to appoint. Mr. John Easter to the Thomas Jefferson Water Resources Protection Foundation with a term to begin February 1, 2016, and to terminate January 31, 2020, and to give him a thank you for.
Do we have a second?
Term.
Second.
Motion made by Ms. Booker, seconded by Mr. Weaver.
And he's
all
sitting
in favor?
Right there. Thank you. Aye. He's sitting right there.
Is he sitting?
He's right behind.
Got a big cheesy smile right there. So, and the chairman votes aye. That'll be 5-0. Okay. Next. X, Y, and Z.
This agreement that is for your approval, when for jurisdictions that do not bill for ambulance services, both of the hospitals that we use refill the drug boxes free at charge. But when you do bill, they usually charge the entities to restock the narcotics in those drug boxes. So this agreement allows for that those charges to come back to the county. We do not bill. We charge flat fees for the ambulance services, not individual drugs. So it's a part. It kind of rolls of it. I've checked with a couple of other counties, and they pay on average about 75 cents to 85 cents per call for the drug, because it really depends if it's BLS care or basic care. There may not be any drug. There would not be any drugs taken care of, and we're not talking Band-Aids. We're talking about the narcotics or the things that are not as easily replaced. So anticipate $1,500 to $2,000, $2,500 at most a year is what this cost would be, and it would come against the cost recovery money, which will be substantially more than that.
Any questions from the board?
Yes. Obvious question is, how are we doing on scheduling the revenue that we're receiving from all of this?
We should be seeing money. There have been runs that have been billed to the insurance company, so I would expect in the next couple weeks that money will be coming in. I will be able to give you a monthly or a bigger report at the end of January, 1st of February, of what the amounts were, because we're still getting a lot of the processes down, missing signatures, or in order to go back to the hospital to get details, they have to have absolutely the correct spelling of the name, date of birth, social security number to be able to match up the calls. So it's taking a little bit just to get those processes in place, but we've had 200 to 300 calls that have gone through the system and that are in some stage of being billed.
So are we going to meet our budget or better
at this point, yes.
This fiscal?
Yes, I believe so.
Do you have a number on the number of calls?
For last year, it's still right around 2,600.
Yeah. It's been pretty consistent.
Yes, over the number of years. And we transport probably 75% of those calls. So it's still, we're still figuring around 2,000 calls that a year that would be billed.
Do they get charged on a patient refusal?
No.
Okay.
No transport, no
transport, no
fees.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. But I thought it was interesting here where you have UVA Medical Center will begin billing, whereas Martha Jefferson will continue to provide
right.
the
service. They see it as a community service, and so they will continue to redo drug boxes. And I understand, too, that we'll keep a good eye on it to make sure that they're not replacing things that weren't in there in the first place. So there'll be a little bit of detail just to stay on top of that.
This is a basic standard practice around the nation.
And basically what you do is you take a box, you have a tackle box that's filled up with the drugs, and if you have to open it, when you get to the hospital, you have to go in and trade it in for a brand new one, and they just give you different another box.
And they're doing
box.
Scheduled drugs, not just regular routine things, because those things we can order and keep in stock at the ambulance station.
These are locked up.
But these are controlled substances.
Right. Does UVA know that Martha Jefferson's not charged?
Yes.
They didn't feel bad.
I tried to make them feel bad.
From somebody for it, so I wouldn't feel too bad for them.
Okay. Any questions from the board?
I
yes,
have
ma'am.
A question. We still have volunteer rescue, don't we?
Yes.
Okay. When the call comes in, how do they decide? Does it go to Martha or to UVA or to our own rescue squad?
Well,
and who makes that decision?
No, it doesn't go to our own rescue squad.
Right.
Our own rescue squad is the only squad that transports in our county.
And we only transport to two. We only
legally allowed to transport in our county is our rescue squad, because the board has authorized them based on state code. So they're the only transport agencies in our county for EMS services.
UVA and Martha Jefferson do not transport. That's just who we take them to.
Okay. And we only service those hospitals. There are other hospitals around, like in Richmond, Farmville area, but we do not transport to those hospitals. And it is sometimes it can be patient It can be the patient requesting to go to Martha Jeff or to UVA. Also, it's the level of acuity of the patient. UVA is obviously a trauma hospital, so if depending on the level of care that is needed, they may automatically go to one or the other.
But the only folks to be licensed EMS transporters in our community is Lake Monticello Rescue and Fluvanna Rescue, and with that, the contract crews that we have. But they're the only licensed EMS rescue responders in our county.
And the county is, the map is drawn out into who is closest with the two.
Scottsville, sorry.
Right, with the squads. So in the lake area, Lake has first due in that area. So if a call comes in at the lake Monticello Rescue would be toned to go to that call. If they're already out on a call, it will be automatically toned to the other squad that's available with a second due crew toned for that call. And it depends a little bit of who responds first in that kind of case. We do have Scottsville Rescue, which is an Albemarle squad, has about 35 miles, square miles, in Fluvanna as their first due. So in the Scottsville area of Fluvanna, if you live there and you call 911, it actually would be toned to the Scottsville squad. In a fire case, if it is a structure fire, everybody goes. I mean, the closest fire will be toned to go.
Fire doesn't do the ambulance restocking.
Right. But just so you understand,
Scottsville
who gets
covers
called
everything
where.
From rolling roads south, okay. I believe.
I'm happy to show you a little more of that in detail.
Okay.
If you want to come in, I can talk for hours.
Yes. Any other questions? Are we good? All right. Do I have a motion?
I move the Board of Supervisors approve the ambulance restocking agreement between the rector and visitors of the University of Virginia on behalf of its medical center in the county of Fluvanna. Documenting the relationship among the medical center, the rescue squads, and the county with regard to restocking of ambulance pharmaceutical and medical supplies, and further authorize the county administrator to execute the agreement subject to approval as to form by the county attorney.
Second.
We have a motion by Ms. Booker, second by Mr. O'Brien. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
And the chair also votes aye, 5-0. Next, A, FY16 E91 radio project CIP budget. Mr. Dahl.
Mr. Chair, members of the board, before you, we have a motion to, it's somewhat administrative in nature. Back in June 17th, the board approved the E911 radio contract with Motorola. At that time, they also approved a capital lease for that project. What this motion pretty much does is basically, it doesn't change the budget of the project, the overall budget of it. What it does is it basically is saying that since we took out a lease for that, the cash that was set aside for that project from the general fund, something needs to happen with that. And is that going to go back into fund balance? So that's kind of the gist of it. Let me go to one slide here really quick just to show you. Okay, so just as a quick recap here. So this is the contract for Motorola. That's a contract for Motorola for the $6.5 million. The board approved to do the construction for the Motorola project as a capital lease. We originally set aside cash for that, but since the board approved a lease and we entered into a lease, the fund balance or the general fund dollars that are there need to have something happen with those funds. At the end of fiscal year 15, we had basically roughly $7 million of general fund money for the overall project. Now, the Motorola contract and the lease only covers the construction of the actual project. It doesn't cover consulting, things of that nature. So that's where less the $7 million, we have roughly $285,000 left that would still need to be funded from general fund dollars that are already been appropriated for the project. Let me go back here.
Here you have cash difference of $385,000.
That's
cover requirements.
The $385,000 is what it was at June 30th, but since then, in fiscal year 16, the board has approved an additional $99,000 for additional consulting through RCC consultants. So the $385,000 less the $99,000 brings us down to the roughly the $285,000.
Right. Okay.
So that's those dollars, general fund dollars, are still needed to fund those things that are not covered within the Motorola lease for the construction. So the motion before you is to basically change, just within our financial system, change the funding source from cash for that to a capital lease, and then basically say that that $6.5 million is going to go back into fund balance for the board to choose what they want to do. So if you see right here, this is where our fund balance is currently. And you see here right now above our policy minimum of the $7.7 million, we have $2.8 million. And then we had $7 million cash set aside for the radio project. So because we did the capital lease, what I'm asking the board to approve is to basically take 6.6 out of this pot right here, and it's going into the green. And then all we're going to have left is roughly the $0.4 million, which is the $385,000 as of basically July 1. So it's just kind of...
Now, as a reminder on that capital lease, that's prepayable at any time without penalty.
Correct.
But we recommended to do that. It was about a 2.68 or 2.63 or 2.86.
That's what I was going to ask.
2.65% interest.
2.65, yeah, so yeah. Very low interest rate. But you could prepay at any time, but what we prefer you do, and the reason we recommend this earlier this year, is we want to show you all the options you can do with paying leases, debt, etc. So that you're off-site, and as part of your prepackage for that, you'll have every debt the county has and how, when they're payable and when they're callable and when what prepayment penalties there are or aren't. So you could figure out what best to do with cash, whether it's for an infrastructure project or paying off existing debt or pay off the Motorola project. The good thing is the board has, for the next couple of years, options, because the Motorola payment, first payment, is not due till fiscal year 18.
And no interest until that.
No interest, no.
And refresh my memory, how much is that leasing?
$1,063,000, I think.
Okay.
For 7 years.
What? Okay.
Yeah. For 7 years?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So like I said, so this motion is just basically to transfer, basically recognize that we did the capital lease, and then we have the $6.6 million there, and it needs to
just move back.
Move back to fund balance. And then, like I said, so
it
from that,
a whole array of options about what to do with cash or debt over the coming months. You'll have that at your offsite, because that'll be a principal thing with some finance things in the morning. But also preset you for budget season, because there's a lot of options in the next 2 years that you'll have to do with cash or with debt or with financing or paying things off.
Yeah, that was one of my concerns, that you'd be paying that 2.85 and it would be just sitting there and we weren't going to use it, but it doesn't kick in until later on the lease, on the $7 million from Motorola.
The 2.65% is the 2.65% is already built into the lease. And so the lease payments are set. They're not going to change.
They're not going to reduce.
You don't start paying it until fiscal year 2018, but it will be set those 7 years, $1,063,000.
I don't know if it's $1,063,000 or $1,073,000. I can't remember.
But less than $1,100,000, but it's a 7 year straight payment, and the interest is already built into those.
And we can pay it off it.
You can pay it off
anytime.
We're basically putting this other money back over where we can start utilizing it.
Well, you can decide how you want to use those dollars, whether it's for this Motorola project or whether it's for something
DLC.
Else.
Or
leave it in savings. The key is you'll have all these things and listed the various interest rates with them and the payoffs on them. So what we will probably make some recommendations on is if you've got a 5% debt, and something else you're going to do is a 3% debt, we'll pay off the 5% debt and with the cash and finance the 4% debt or the 3% debt.
if you have to do a mishmash between the
There's a whole lot of options with this. Like I said, we'll have $9.4 million, which is above our targeted balance, and then we'll have the 7.7, which is kind of like our threshold for where we need to stay at.
All righty. Any other questions? Okay, do I have a motion?
I move the Board of Supervisors approve a budget amendment in FY16 CIP budget for the E91 radio project to change $6,594,544.94 as a funding source for the project from general fund cash to a capital lease to reflect the Motorola credit lease the Board of Supervisors approved effective July 1st, 2015, and further transfer the $6,594,544.94 back to the general fund's unassigned balance.
Second. I have a second. I have a motion by Mr. O'Brien, a second by Ms. Eager. All in favor?
Aye.
Chair votes aye, 5-0. Thought you were Joey Zuzu for a second. All righty. B, Pleasant Grove House Museum Security System Funding Request.
Mr. Chairman, members of the board, Happy New Year. This is a follow-up from about a month ago. We had an attempted break-in at the Pleasant Grove House Museum. Rather than wait until next fiscal year and request this budget, we'd like to move forward with a contingency budget request and get this done as soon as possible.
How could you tell that they were trying to break in?
There were two doors where we saw that someone tried to wedge either a screwdriver or some kind of flathead device and jam it in there.
I forgot to link up the pictures. I have pictures of all the doors and window jams where they jimmied.
There was one window on the bottom floor next to one of the main entrances that we noticed that somebody had tried to come in underneath.
But they never succeeded, did they?
No. So the $3,100 is for the equipment. Along with that, it would be a $400 or $395 annual fee to maintain the system.
So they maintain the system, whoever puts the system.
Right. So there would be a box on the first floor. Each person that needed to use or get into the facility would have a separate code, so we'd know we could backtrack and see who was going in, who was leaving. But that would be on the main floor, visible. So if we had members who were coming in just to give themselves a tour or come in for a tour, they would actually see. So if there was somebody who was trying to figure out how can I get into this place, they'd see that there is a security box there.
Right. And this is wireless?
Yes. Yep.
Okay.
Any other? Okay. Do I have a motion?
Ready for a motion?
Yes, sir.
I move the Board of Supervisors approve a budget transfer of $3,100 for the installation of the security system to Pleasant Grove House from the year 16 Board of Supervisors contingency to the year 16 Parks and Recreation Contract Service Budget.
All right. Do I have a second?
Second.
Motion made by Mr. Weaver, seconded by Mr. O'Brien. All in favor?
Aye.
Chair votes aye, 5-0.
Thank you.
Number C.
Mr. Chair, it's 5:30, and the next two items will probably take more than just a couple minutes, and I really think you need to get to your closed session and put these off until the second part of the meeting if you can.
Sure.
Okay.
We recommend that. We've got folks waiting. So.
Okay.
All righty.
So maybe a motion to recess.
Do we have a motion to recess?
Second.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Chair votes aye. It's 5-0.
We need a motion to reconvene in closed session.
And
right
motion,
now?
Yes. Motion.
Mr. Weaver's got
it. Let me get my glasses out. Mr. Chair. I move the Susanna County Board of Supervisors enter into a closed meeting pursuant to the provisions of Section 2.2-3711A.6, Section 2.2-3711A.7 of the Code of Virginia 1950 as amended for the purpose of discussing investment of funds and legal matters.
Do I have a second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Chair votes aye. 5-0.
In Morris Room.
We're headed to the Morris Room.
Okay.
See y'all in a little bit.
We can do motions. Yeah. Come on,
back
close session.
Order.
I'd like to call this meeting back to order.
Mr. Chair, I move the closed meeting be adjourned and the Fluvanna County Board of Supervisors convene again in open session. Be it resolved, the Board of Supervisors does hereby certify that to the best of each member's knowledge, only public business matters lawfully exempted from open meeting requirements under Section 2.2-3711-8 of the Code of Virginia 1950 as amended and only such public business matters as were identified in the motion by which the closed meeting was convened were heard, discussed, or considered in the meeting.
Okay, do I have a second for that?
Second.
I have a motion by Mr. Weaver, second by Ms. Booker, and this will be a call vote.
A second and a recorded vote needed.
Aye.
Ms. Booker, aye. Mr. Weaver?
Aye.
Ms.
Aye.
Eager? Mr. O'Brien?
Aye.
Chair votes aye. 5-0. Now, we're going to go to public hearings. All right, let me find my page here. Is that number six?
Okay.
That's number six.
The public hearing is on the back of your green sheet right here.
And that is going to be public hearing for the relocation of the Rivanna District 501 polling precinct from the Lake Monticello Owner Association Clubhouse building to the Lake Monticello Firehouse Maple Room. We will start a round of public comment for this public hearing.
Staff first.
Staff first. Call staff presenter to the podium for the briefing.
No problem. I'm at the podium, and I'm not sure if there's an electoral board member here. Joyce is here, but the electoral board chair could not make it tonight, but our registrar is here. In this case, though, you've seen the documents from your last meeting where you approved advertising for a public hearing for a relocation in our ordinance of the polling station for the Rivanna district from the Lake Monticello Clubhouse to the Lake Monticello Firehouse Maple Room. That's because there's construction ongoing for the next few months or year, and there's multiple primary elections and the general election this year. So the ordinance to amend is attached in your package, and essentially it just says it's relocating and revising the ordinance to from the Lake Monticello Clubhouse to Lake Monticello Firehouse, comma, Maple Room.
All righty, any questions from the board?
No.
Mm-hmm. All righty.
Public comment.
Yeah. Public, we do not need to have the applicant or anybody to speak. So any questions from the board? Hearing none, we'll open the public hearing. Please keep your comments to 5 minutes on topic and direct it to the board. Also, we will hear your comments. We will refrain from our addressing back to them, and we will answer them when it gets to new business if we need to, or we'll have staff address them with you later on. Is there anyone who would like to come to the podium? Nobody's speaking, so I'm going to close that round of public comment. With no one else wishing to speak, we will close public hearing. Any questions or comments from the board?
No.
Do we have a motion?
Yes. I move the Board of Supervisors approve the resolution and ordinance to amend Chapter 2, Article 2, Section 2-2-3, parenthesis A, of the Rivanna County Code to remove the Rivanna Election District polling place from the Lake Monticello Clubhouse to the Maple Room Lake Monticello Firehouse.
Do I have a second?
Second.
We have a motion by Mrs. Booker. We have a second by Mrs. Eager. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
The chair votes aye. Be 5-0. All right. Now we will go back to C.
Mr. Chairman, did you close the public hearing?
Oh,
you did.
I'm sorry.
Yes.
Okay.
I hit the gavel.
Okay.
That's thank you. Keep me in line, sir.
What you did is fine, but it is the better practice to announce that you're closing the public hearing.
Okay. We'll now move on to C in action matters, the reclassification of deputy sheriff positions. Sheriff Hess.
Thank you, sir. Basically, what I'm asking y'all to do today is to simplify a procedure where when somebody is shifted from one position to another, that it doesn't require all the paperwork that entails when you shift them around from one pay band to another. Basically, the bottom line is to clean up the verbiage of everything. Everybody's a deputy sheriff first. And in the future, I'll work with Gail some more to clean up. Like bailiffs are pretty much, it's an old term name for someone who works in and serves in the courthouse. But as far as the comm board and all, they're identified as court service workers, and we won't be able to be flexible to move people around as they need to be moved around. Example is an SRO, you know, probably about 3 to 4 years, they need to be moved around. So it just simplifies the way we do things. And the other changing of the deputy bailiff's positions, which is pretty much an incorrect term, like I was explaining, they need to be deputy sheriffs.
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir.
I guess I do have a question. You have here, in addition, I moved to eliminate 26411, so on and so forth. I'm just wondering maybe why they weren't eliminated 2 years ago or a year ago.
Well, it's until I went to Human Resources and asked to advertise for a deputy sheriff, and I wasn't able to because they were listed as bailiffs, when in fact to have a bailiff to work part-time in the courts is on a much lower pay scale. As you see down there, pay band 9, that's way down there. So it kind of takes two of those to make a deputy.
Part-time
deputy, correct. But the bottom line is that everybody at the sheriff's office, other than civilian staff, are deputy sheriffs, and they have different functions. And then, until you get into the investigative side, where you would go to another pay band, and then progress up with like sergeants, lieutenants, and such, you'd move up in a pay band. With the additional certifications now, with what the county's done with the pay bonuses, so when a person becomes an SRO, an ACO, or a court service worker, which is a separate certification from law enforcement, then they apply for that $500 bump in pay.
Anyone else?
Any other?
What's a COR?
Pardon?
COR. What is COR? What is
SRO?
No, I see COR too. COR.
On there?
Next
Commissioner Revenue is for the next presentation.
Oh, I'm going for
Here's
the Commissioner Revenue's presentation.
You're just ahead of us.
This one's a big one. That's a little one.
Oh, that's a little one.
Yeah.
Okay.
So essentially, though, he's taking 22 current positions that represent 20.5 full-time equivalents, changing to 21 positions, but reclassifying the names and the pay bands, and making it 20 full-time equivalents. And the current costs for those relationships, and Ms. Parrish estimated high on hiring costs to make sure that we were comparing apples to, you know, new oranges. And this, so it's still either neutral or a little less, even though she used high estimates on the new hires in those positions.
You said something about changing people like the SOR.
Correct. Yes, ma'am.
Are you thinking about changing the middle school SR to high, what do you mean change?
Well,
I don't work for a certain time. Does a new one come in? Or
yes, what? Ma'am. It's recommended in the schooling that the SROs go to that they only do between 3 to 4 years, and then they need to be moved to somewhere else.
That sounds good.
Right, and periodically people ask for transfers because they become, you know, well, I've been doing this for 4 years. Mm-hmm. Can I do this for a little while to have a change of pace?
Right. Okay.
Yes, ma'am.
That makes sense.
Okay. Thank you much.
That's a lot to read there.
All right. You could maybe say as stated if Mr.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering about. But
okay. Do we have a motion?
Well, I'll make the motion. I'll read it off. I move to consolidate with the pay band schematic, the following job position titles and classifications from 6411 Deputy Bailiff Court Services, pay band 12, 6411 Bailiff Court Service Part Time, pay band 9, 6511 Deputy Bailiff Court Service, pay band 13, 6311 Deputy Animal Control, pay band 11, 6312 Deputy Animal Control Officer, pay band 13, 6521, Deputy School Resource Officer, pay band 14, 6511, Deputy Sheriff Patrol Courts, ACO, SRO, pay band 13. In addition,
Mr.
I moved.
Weary, you meant to say two.
Did I miss something?
Yeah, the word two. You missed the word two.
Okay.
You're going from the one
four,
on the top,
six, five,
to
one,
the
one
on the bottom.
Okay. In addition, I moved to eliminate 26411 Deputy Bailiff Court Service, part-time pay band 9, currently funded at $27,040, and replaced with 16511-Deputy Sheriff Patrol Courts-ACO-SRO, parentheses, part-time pay band 13, at a cost of $21,520. Anybody else could have had that next week?
Okay, we've had a motion made by Mr. Weaver, seconded by Ms. Eager. All in favor?
Aye.
All opposed? Chairman votes aye, 5-0.
No one fought over that one, did they?
Now we go to the COR.
Okay, now we're going to D, Deputy Clerk Position Upgrade, Office of the Commissioner of the Revenue, Mel Sheridan, Commissioner of the Revenue.
Thank you, sir. Ladies and gentlemen of the board, as part of the annual position and grade review, all departments really were asked if they take the opportunity to rewrite job descriptions to have them more closely describe what the individual may be doing in that specific position. So I took the opportunity to do that and provided those to our HR department. And Ms. Parrish reviewed them, and she recommended, and I certainly would agree, that the Deputy 1 position, because of the duties assigned to that position, it's a manager's role. They are the program manager for all business personal property, the entire business personal property database, and the program manager for the public utilities database, both very large databases. She thought it was very appropriate, and I concurred. So I asked Mr. Nichols if he would take a look at it for his concurrence, having that position changed from a Deputy 1 to a Deputy 2 position. That does represent on the pay band a slight change in the salary, the minimum salary. We tried to reflect that there. The minimum salary would move to $31,200 for pay band 10. And if the board is so inclined to support this request, it's our position that we would not hire anyone that would require any additional dollars than what we already have allocated for this year. But it would allow me to hire someone in that position who may have slightly better qualifications, maybe a little more experience, because of the work that they do. They are, in fact, a manager of those two major databases, and they are also the primary trainer on our staff for everyone else in the office to be versed in the management of the same data. So with that, I've submitted it, and I would greatly appreciate your support of the request. Be happy to entertain any questions you may have.
Questions from the board?
How many staff members do you have now?
I have four. This is a vacant position currently.
Okay, and you're not going to do it? Oh, you have four, period.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And, he has one vacancy.
Yeah,
one vacancy. And when you have a vacancy, is the only reasonable time we can adjust positions or change position descriptions. So I've always told any of our department heads or our constitutional officers, whenever the vacancy comes open, is the time when they need to review their documents, because before they hire a new person, they need to make sure everything's in order, rather than just hiring what they've always hired. In this case, Ms. Parrish worked on the classification for it, and it shows that position should be a D2 instead of a D1. But in any case, what we did is we classified the dollars on the currently funded positions. Those folks are moving up to the next slots. But when they get hired, you can see on the screen there that the current total staff salary is $150,535. But this is for the four staff members. But the new staff salary, even if we got the most highly qualified person, it would go to 153, but Mr. Sheridan's already said that he would be hiring at the base level. That means you'd be at 148,642.
So you're saving.
Save a couple thousand dollars.
I do think it would help me hopefully attract,
quality candidates.
And not that they aren't all good, but if I have the opportunity to hire someone with more education, more experience, it's because I'm expecting them to manage those databases, and they do. That's the requirement of the position. It's not just an administrative, position. This time, yes.
Okay.
We're talking about you.
Yes, sir.
Any other questions? Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Do we have a motion?
I move to approve the position upgrade of the current deputy COR1 pay band 9 to deputy COR2 business personal property manager pay band 10.
Do I have a second?
Second.
We have a motion made by Ms. Seeger, seconded by Mr. Weaver. All in favor?
Aye.
All opposed? Chair votes aye, 5-0.
Thank you, sir. I'd also like to just one quick plug. I appreciate the support that the HR staff has given me in rewriting all the job descriptions. Mr. Nichols, very helpful, too. You're always there when we're not happy, but I like to tell you when we are. Thank you.
Okay, and that will mean
later.
We're going to go on to staff presentations, but before we do that, I am going to hand pass the gavel to Ms. Booker, and I've been out past doctor's orders now, so.
Okay. So we have presentations, water tank in the James River. Mr. Wayne Stevens.
Good evening, Madam Chair and members of the board, or Madam Interim Chair or Vice Chair or whatever.
Gets confusing after
a while. She's got a hammer in her hand. She's in charge.
She's whoever she wants to be. I am not sure how many of you know this. Some of you might already know this, but there's a county-owned water storage tank in the middle of the James River. Probably everybody already knows about it. It's been there for 42 years or 43
years. I've gone around it before.
So the basic history, as I've been able to piece it together since I was in the third grade when it happened, is that, of course, I think everybody's aware that the former Fuzzy Water Treatment Plant in Bremo was washed away in 1972. Well, it utilized two water storage tanks. They're horizontally arranged on cradles, probably about 25,000-30,000 gallons each, roughly 12 to 15 feet in diameter and maybe 40 feet long. And in June of 1972, flooding caused by Hurricane Agnes destroyed that water treatment plant. And during the flood, one of the water storage tanks was washed into the James River. And it actually went more than 2.5 miles downstream from Bremo, where it came to rest just downstream of a rock ledge, which I have to think had something to do with where it got deposited. And it's, I say roughly in the middle, but in all honesty, it's quite a bit closer to the Buckingham side than it is to the Fluvanna side. Roger Black and I were measuring the other day. I think it's 160 feet from the Buckingham shoreline, and it's about 380 feet or 390 feet or so to the Fluvanna.
Is that significant?
It might have an impact on exactly how you try to approach getting it out of there should you decide to do that, but it's been there ever since. Now, recently, of course, we've been having a lot of public meetings about water, and at least two of those, different citizens have stood up and inquired about the fact that this water tank's been sitting in the middle of the river for 43 years and hasn't had anything done about it. This map is a little bit darker than I'd hoped it turned out, but I've got a little orange circle up there in the top left that says Bremo, and then there's a little orange circle down there just past that bend in the river that is the storage tank. And as far as river miles go, it measures out at almost exactly 2.7 miles. I don't show very much of the Buckingham side there. It's kind of accessible from either side, but there's a picture of it.
That's Mr. Weaver in the canoe.
You can see, roughly, that canoe's probably 12 feet long. I think that's about the length of a normal average canoe. So you can see that tank's probably at least 30 feet long,
and
maybe a little longer.
And it's never moved over all that time.
And it's just been sitting there. You can see it got pretty beat up. Now, those things are made out of steel that's probably 3/8 to half an inch thick. And so it definitely took a beating. Somebody came in after this, I think, and decided to make a pirate out of the smiley face. But I'm not sure whether that's, this may also affect how you can get the tank out of the river. That appears like it might be a breach, a break at a weld on the tank. It could also just be a shadow on the picture. I've not actually been in the river to see the tank. But you can see this is the Buckingham. You're looking at the Buckingham side there and at the Fluvanna side there. So it's quite a bit closer to the Buckingham shoreline than it is. And that's just straight down the river looking at the tank. Basically, there's a few issues about it. But first of all, it's kind of outside the area of expertise of anybody that's employed by the county. I'm not exactly into aquatic or marine salvage, and I don't know of any other anybody employed by the county that is. But we've got some issues that may affect the cost and complexity of removing the tank from the river. One is the condition. If it's got a large breach in it, it means it's probably most of the way filled up with silt. In fact, it's probably most of the way filled up with silt anyway, because it's managed to stay there in the river through, I just learned this the other day. Camille was another large storm. Mm-hmm. Obviously, that came before Agnes. But then since then, Hugo in 1985 actually resulted in a higher, by about a foot, flood stage than Camille did. Still 4 feet short of what Agnes brought onto the James. But in 1985, apparently that tank, again, didn't move. It survived that Hugo flood.
The storms weren't in 79 and 83, something like that.
It was 69 was Camille, and then 72 was Agnes, and then 85 was the next super high water, and that was Hugo. That surprised me. I didn't realize that Hugo had caused that high a flood level in the James. But access. Now, it's private property, both sides of the river. I wish I'd brought you a map that showed you a little bit more of the properties on the other side, but it appears like the tank would be easier to access from the Buckingham side of the river. There's a farm there. There's a farm road that literally points almost straight at the tank, and it ends about 150 or 200 feet short of the shoreline, and in between is a tilled field. So with some type of tracked equipment, you could, when it's dry, you could relatively easily move across. I'm just speculating here, even if you had to cut the thing up with welding torches and bring it to the shore, you could get a piece of equipment in there that could perhaps lift it onto trucks or something and haul it off. But access is definitely an issue. Have to get permission or negotiate with private property owners to get to it. Regulatory, I honestly don't have any idea whether the state, federal governments have any rules, regulations, whether a permit is needed to go in and get this thing out. I suspect in 1972 there probably wasn't anything that would have prevented it from getting out, but now it's hard to say. So we would have to spend some staff or legal time looking into that. And then, of course, the cost. I've inquired just very initially of a couple of local contractors, just general construction contractors, and they're not really all that interested in tackling it. So you may very well be looking at an aquatic or marine salvage type outfit that specializes in salvaging things from the water. And of course, the salvage value of that tank is very minimal. It's steel. You can sell it for scrap, but price of steel isn't very high right now, and it is likely to be very, very far less than it'll cost to get the thing out of the river.
Can you tell them they can keep anything that's inside it?
Sure, we could do that. But
all the fish.
Basically, we're seeking guidance on this thing. I mean, it's been in the river 43 years, and I've been here 3.5 years, and just recently was the first time anybody had inquired to me about
almost
doing anything about the tank. So I'm basically going to just kind of ask a question. Does the board want us to do some more research and invest some additional time and effort into researching the cost and logistics of actually trying to get this thing out of the river? Or I was thinking, 7 more years, it'll been there 50 years, maybe we can get it on the National Register of Historic Places, and then it'll be protected.
It seems to me it's an historical
I think it is historical, right?
Yeah, so
leave the faces on it, too.
So the question is before us, so what do you think?
Too.
No, seriously, though, if it, we're all very busy. We've got a lot of things that we're doing.
That's what I'm saying.
I'm willing to do this, but I really like just to make sure that the board, that's one of the things y'all want me to be looking into, or want us to be looking into.
If you want us to turn it over to one of our contract engineering firms to research this.
And but even that itself, of course, is going to cost a little bit of money.
And we would have to pay for them,
yeah,
too.
do that. What do y'all think? What's your?
I say leave it there and wait till somebody really has a major complaint. You know, it's good fishing around there. Should be some fish around there.
Well, you know, you bring up a point. Obviously, somebody finds the tank to be a little bit of amusing or whatever. And
yeah.
In this day and age, you never can tell that you might have somebody that doesn't want you to take it out of the river. But all I know is that
I guarantee if we take it out, there's going to be people that will complain.
All I know is that the people that have approached me are interested in having it removed.
And did they say why?
Well, it's just, you know, it doesn't belong there, I guess. It's not a natural
feature.
I think we could strike a deal with Buckingham and
change the face
maybe change
every
the deal
year.
Afterwards. I don't know.
We could change the face every to smile to a frown to.
We could put the county seal on the end.
So we're going to let sleeping tanks lie.
Yes.
Anyway, I don't expect an answer tonight, but I mean, I just right, kind of a consensus, and I believe I may have already gotten what I was looking for. So, all right,
that's something good.
Community support.
Yeah, the community may want to go out there and do something, have a tug of war to try to pull it up. All right, the next thing that we have is the E911 radio project update, towel requirements. Ms. Cheryl Elliott.
So I want to just precursor Cheryl's brief here because she's got a very good brief to present to you, but it's incredibly complicated. Mm-hmm. There's lots of layers to it. Mm-hmm. Most of the real dollars are not included in these slides because they're contractual, and we'll have to do that in closed session with you sometime. But it may be useful for you all to come and have some one-on-ones with Cheryl to go through this because there's a lot of levels of complexity on the potential permutations of the tower requirements for this project. So mm-hmm. we've got a package for you that I'll give you when we go back over to the other room.
And I also wanted good evening and thank you for listening to me. in the background too, in the RFP, we requested that Motorola build a system based on coverage requirements for the county, and told them we would prefer to use towers that are existing or that are county owned, and we gave them the list of what we had available. So they designed the system with that in mind for those sites. And now at this point of negotiating the leases and figuring out exactly where the sites are, which towers, like on Carter's Mountain, which towers we can use, and what the pricing would be with that, the costs are more because of the way that the system is designed on the tower, which I will show you a little more on that. So got to thinking, what other alternatives do we have for this to be able to make the best use of the dollars that we will be spending? And there's a couple of options that we need your guidance as to which direction to go, because we don't want to go down the line of negotiating leases if we want to do something a little different. So the next steps of we need some guidance on the site, on the way to approach these sites. And then the next stage is to lease the tower sites and then secure frequencies based on those particular sites. The monthly costs of leasing towers ranges from about $1,800 to about $4,700 a month per section on the tower. Now, our system has 7 sites, which is, they're shown in the circles there. We circled the Carter's Mountain one in red so it would stand out a little bit more. 4 of these are transmit and receive sites, and 3 are receive only. All that means is that for the transmit and receive sites, you're talking double the equipment, double antennas, microwave dishes, and that kind of thing. So there's more equipment on the towers. The towers are normally broken into 10-foot sections, and our ordinances, and when we have cell carriers come in and want to build towers, we tell them we want you to make sure you build them so that there can be 6 different carriers on the site. So essentially it means the top 60 feet are where the cell carriers are going to be. So now, based on our showing you 2 placement here examples. The one on the left is the Morris site, and the one on the right is the Cohasset site. The Morris site is a receive only, so you see the little antenna at the top. This one doesn't have a... Yeah, right here, this little stick that's up there is the antenna.
Yeah.
This is a microwave dish, and this is a microwave dish. This array here is a cell carrier. That's what the cell carriers would look like. So if you had six of those on the tower, they would be... there would be six of these like stacked up, and they're usually 6 to 8 feet in height.
Now, how tall is this tower?
All of our towers are 195.
All of them are 195.
Right, except for the BRIMO Dominion one, and that's 325 feet.
Yeah, right.
We have some existing smaller towers in our county, but
right.
what we allow now is up to 100, up to 199.
So,
right.
You want to put a
so they don't have to be lighted.
Right.
And then I'll just go get FAA approval and things.
Yeah.
Like.
Right.
Okay.
So
is this our tower right here, or is it going to be built? Or?
Both of these towers are built. The Morris is one of the 5280 sites.
Mm-hmm.
That's the one on below. Route 6
that's
along
your road.
Okay.
No,
this one's on BRIMO Road, but it's about a half a mile south of Route 6.
Yeah.
Cohasset is over more toward Mrs. Corpus. And these are drawings for this particular site. This is where our equipment would go. Now, and if you can read the little fine print about what the heights are, these heights on these or where these are set on the tower are by design to be able to get the coverage we need. The Cohasset tower, for example, there's no cell carriers on there at this point, but they have two that have verbal agreements to go on the site. So the way that our equipment is on here, these are our receive antennas, and this is the transmit, and I'm sorry, this is the this is the receive, and these are the transmit. Are lower on the tower. If you look at how much space we're taking up, this is 70 feet. The microwave dishes can be combined a little bit, but if we go with this design, we would be taking up six sections of this tower, which they're designed for six carriers. So, this is just an example of how of the design. So I'm going to present you several options of how we can handle this and approximate costs. And as Mr. Nichols said, we'll give you much more detail about the costs. But a lot of this is we are in process of negotiating. So all these dollar amounts are pre-negotiation estimates. Some of them are a little more finalized than others. But I won't. So in the presentation, I won't give specifics about. You know, I can tell you, like Carter's Mountain is much more expensive than the VFW, for example.
Yeah,
but you will get that information later.
The one that you are calling the Cohasset Tower, in my opinion, is misnamed. It is really the Mountain Hill Road.
Right. These are named as to what the tower owner calls them.
Oh,
that's
because that's not in Cohasset.
Right, it's not on. It's in the Cohasset area, but it is on Mountain Hill.
It's
not
area.
It's
on the tracks in Cohasset area.
Right.
This is on Shores Road, going to on Mountain Hill Road.
Okay.
So option one is the way the original design when Motorola looked at our system and to give us the 95% coverage across the county and put all of the equipment on the towers. They were put on, like the microwave dishes were put on the towers as to what would make the coverage and make the links, connect the links appropriately given our terrain and all of that. So there are some places where things can be squished a little bit more. And we did that in looking at the original design, what would be involved. So what we're saying is that on these sites, the Carter's Mountain, VFW, Cohasset, Morris, and the Clocum sites would all be leased, that we would pay for however many sections of the tower were needed based on what was required. Dominion has a 325-foot tower, and they are in that tower has outlived its life and is in process of being replaced. They will be coming to the Planning Commission to redo that. It's also built on ash, so it needs to be moved. They're hoping within the same properties that they own, but just moving it 100 to 200 feet. And there's a possibility of them asking for that to go to 350 from 325, which it's already a lit tower. It, you know, to go up another 25 feet really doesn't make any difference. This is one of their tower will be one of the towers that will be monitoring the new pipeline, and that's why they're wanting to redo it. They allow us to have public safety equipment on that tower free of charge. In
which
fact,
one are you talking about?
The Primo Dominion. Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. And that one. So we want to make as much use of that one as we can.
Sure do.
Because it is free. Nope. And then the sheriff's office one is the new one that we would be building at the sheriff's office.
Be building.
Yes.
That cost is included in the contract cost for Motorola. Okay.
Yes.
That's the same tower.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
We recently passed two other towers, and I thought we had included in that there would be, you know, favorable terms for the lease. I remember last year.
There was one new Verizon tower that's only 125 feet, and that one, the original lease on or the original SUP, gives public safety free access to it. The subsequent conditions for all of our towers say that we have first right of refusal. So for these two, which are the 5280 sites,
the T-Mobile sites?
Yes. The 5280 sites, those we have first right of refusal as in the Cohasset one, which means if they come and say, we have two carriers on Cohasset that we want to be on there, and we can say, no, we want that space.
We say we want top space, or if we don't need it then and we can go down one, that's fine. But we have first right of refusal, so before they put a commercial carrier on to take up space, they have to ask us.
So we, because
that doesn't mean we get it for free.
Yeah, but we actually asked that question, and it wasn't something that, or asked that question, it was something that we couldn't ask for as part of the SUP condition.
Right. And older, but I thought we were asking for that.
Older SUPs said it gave us a lot more leniency. Than the most recent ones.
3 years ago, you changed your policy to require us to have top billing unless we didn't want it. In other words, first right of refusal.
But not top billing. First right of refusal to be on it, but it doesn't say anything about where on the tower.
No.
So they could give us and say, yes, you can be on our tower, but like Cohasset is saying right now, you can have space, but we want you to be below 165 feet. Well, below 165 feet doesn't, we can't, none of our equipment, all of our equipment has to be above that. So there's some problems.
So that's just to be clear, that's part of the ordinance then. Is that correct? In terms of it's how we phrase for the purpose of towers, how we phrase whether or not public safety is at a discount or negotiated discount. Is that part of the ordinance?
I don't know if it's the ordinance or the staff conditions.
Changed when you refer that it was changed? Top billing versus, you know, right of first refusal, is that in the ordinance?
It was a special use permit condition for approval of towers.
I don't think it was specific as to location.
But we're applying that policy to all tower applications?
All tower applications.
Maybe we need to revisit that. I mean, maybe we need to revisit that.
And, I would recommend that it is a little more stringent on the conditions. That especially if there are areas that we anticipate needing, because at this point now, going into negotiations, the conditions aren't necessarily as favorable to the county as what they could be if the language was a little stronger.
Yeah,
you have to be careful with the language. You can't just say we get top billing and we get free.
Right. They made it sound when they were going through the SUP process that they were going to provide, and I think if you listen to the tapes,
5280 said we look very favorably upon putting emergency communications on our towers.
Right.
And they will absolutely give us space on our towers.
Right. And space where we're asked. On those two, it's space where we've asked for.
and it is.
Well, that's right. The very favorably, I was uncomfortable with the way you phrased that because it didn't sound like it was a special deal or anything.
Well, who's on the Cohasset towel if they want us to go down so far?
There is nobody on there right now. It was approved. It was approved for AT&T.
Yes.
But I think there are two carriers that have expressed interest. Now, the owner, this tower was just recently sold. And the new owner management company is saying they have interest from two carriers, but that has not come to the Planning Commission, which it will have to because it's a modification on the tower anytime new carriers are added.
Right.
So we haven't seen anything. We just heard verbally and in the negotiations and talking with them. Well, we have two carriers that are interested, and of course they're going to want those top. Those top sections.
And oh, by the way, all these carriers and all these tower companies know that we're looking for space.
Yes. Of course.
It didn't help either, does it?
No. Well, it's not, we can't do anything about it. I mean, this is all public record stuff, and they know we're looking for space.
So looking at this and looking at the different, like some of these, we would need more sections of the tower than others. With that, so what this does is it based on all of what we would need as it was originally designed, it would be about $50,000 a month for lease. The annual cost in each of the options, you'll have a box up here in the corner, and the $50,000 is the lease amount. The year cost also includes maintenance or operation costs that would be associated with that site. And then this is a number that would represent what you would spend with this option over a 10-year period, and it does have a plus up on the leases for years for the second half of the 10 years. Okay. Option two that we looked at is, what if we would shorten the antennas and go directional? In the design, they are omnidirectional, and they are 20 feet tall. So right away, if you put that on a tower, you're taking up two spaces. They can go through a cellular array, but it's line of sight. So if it hits something in front of it, it's going to block it getting to the antenna. So it's better not to have them go up through things. So you would basically put a 20-foot antenna in a 20-foot section on that tower. Two of the sites could benefit from shorter directional antennas, and then you have to focus them very, very carefully on how they can meet each other on those. And then that would in turn reduce the amount of space that we would need on the tower. The one thing with Cohasset and Morris and Carter's Mountain cannot use shorter antennas. It has to do, again, with the line of sight. So it reduces the cost, but not substantially.
And the benefit of having the omnidirectional over the directional antennas
is greater because you have, I mean, again, we're wanting to get with the highest coverage area, and when you're going with a shorter antenna and more directional, you can lose some signal. But they were doing, and if we would decide to go this way, they would do some more tests to make sure we get the coverage. And remember, they have guaranteed us 95% coverage. So if for some reason, if we would go this route and then come back and we didn't get the coverage, they would have to add additional antennas, or they would have to do something to make sure that they meet that coverage that they have promised.
And they'd probably find a way to say it was our responsibility
for
the cost.
But the directional antennas, you're talking about the point-to-point components of the antennas, not the antennas that are actually used for distributing the signal to the radios.
No, it would be that.
It would be the
receive and the transmit antennas.
Well, you're going to have receive and transmit between towers.
Right, antennas.
And then you're going to have an array around to go so that the radios can receive the signal, and those are connected to the other tower, to the other radios that are the point-to-point radios.
Right. So you'd have the smaller, I mean, on the cars, on the vehicles, you're going to have some antennas, and then obviously on the portables, you have antennas too. But these would be for the portables to reach back to the bigger system. They hit those antennas.
Okay.
So an option three is to light the towers, and to place those receive antennas up on top of the tower. Our towers are 195. So if we would put that antenna at the very top at 195, 199, and it let it extend, it would mean lighting the tower, but that is useless space for the tower owner at this point, and that would be free for the county because it's not space that they can use. And then it would mean that on the tower itself we would still need the microwave dishes, but it really lowers the amount of space on the tower. The Cohasset site right now is a transmit and receive site, which requires that transmit antenna to 20-foot antenna on the tower. So you're talking two sections of the tower right there. One option that this looks at is making Cohasset a receive only and making the BREMO one a receive and transmit. It's a taller tower, so it would give they're fairly certain that it would give us the same amount of coverage, and actually better coverage, because the antennas can be higher on the BREMO tower than on the Cohasset, and then it limits the space that we would need on the Cohasset tower. So, and then it substantially brings down the lease costs. Essentially, you have the Carter's Mountain that remains the same, and then it goes down to like two spaces here, one space here, and one here, as far as the spacing. So pricing-wise, it really brings down the cost. And I'll show you here, this is the drawings for the VFW. This is, and this kind of shows you the rad sections, or the sections of the tower. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 is the way that our ordinance says you need to prepare a tower to be able to have 6 carriers. If this tower was full, that's what it would look like with the six cell arrays on it. So as our equipment is on here, we have one antenna, that's the 20-foot antenna, and the one microwave dish. And this is up on using three sections the way this would be. And this one would probably be centered in that third space. So that would be using three sections. And if they charge us $2,000 a section, that would be this would cost us $6,000 a month. This, because this is useless space up here for the tower company, they would allow us to be up here with our 20-foot antenna that goes up. We would only be renting one rad center, say, and if it was $2,000, this tower would only cost us $2,000 a month compared to $6,000. The process for the lighting is, because this is a public safety county project, it does not have to go through SUPs for lighting. That's a decision that you can make, and to allow that to happen. It's basically a checkbox on the application with the FAA for a modification of the tower height. Now, it's not a physical modification, because this tower is still 195. On that, but it allows for the antennas to go up. They will say okay, and this is the kind of lighting that you need to put on it. Then we would install the lighting and have it operational before that antenna can go on the tower. So it's a several week process to get that approved and moving forward.
601 is in
Kentstor.
So Falk Union would be really lit up.
It would be.
These are pretty innocuous lights.
Yeah, it's a red during the day and white at night, I believe. They're red at night, red in the day and white at night, I believe.
And they're LEDs. Don't they spin?
Some flash.
Some of them flash.
They're just blinkers, depending on the height of the tower.
Some of them are Charlotte's, yeah.
Yeah, I've seen them, but I see that we have one in BREMO, we have 106. Yeah.
So another option would be to build county sites. And when we approached this process, we were wanting to use existing towers and to make use of that. But looking at the options that are for and the best use of money and going forward, what can we do? So the Carter's Mountain is not for sale. I mean, to get space up there to build another tower is substantial. I mean, Albemarle is paying about $80,000 a year for their space, and then they have to revenue share with the landowner. I mean, there's a lot of things that are happening that is not. And there's a number of options up there for us. The Morris site, this is south of on Bremo Road, south of about six, about half a mile. Because of where this is located, we would not recommend that we consider building we would use that tower. This one in Kent Store, the tower is not set for sale, but remember, this is the piece of property that 5280 bought that there's 16 acres. And if we would want to build a tower that had all of our stuff on, it wouldn't, you know, not necessarily light it, but we just put all our stuff on it, we could build on their site. But it would be unlikely that we could sell additional space to get any kind of revenue on that tower. The sheriff's office, we are already planning that we could add two carriers to that as far as revenue projections. The VFW site is not yet built. The owners are the company that has the lease with the VFW are willing to build it, but they want a signed contract for a lease contract in place with the county before they will build. So whether this is one site that we may want to consider building our own tower. And the Cohasset site, like I said, it was just recently sold to another carrier. We could potentially build nearby, or we could potentially have Motorola look at coverage areas and maybe build another tower that would cover this area but be far enough in distance that would attractive to carriers, because we know in that area there just is very poor cell coverage. But again, like I mentioned in one of my other presentations, cell carriers choose towers based on how many customers they have. So it may or may not be advantageous for the carriers.
That's almost all rural preservation down that way, right?
Yeah, but rural preservation doesn't have anything to do with this part. What it has to do with this is density of the population.
No, that's what I mean. The rural preservation means the density is going to be low.
Well, yeah, right.
For the county to build...
Remember, when you see those terms, potential revenue, potential's in big quotes.
Right, underline.
And there's no guarantee that any carrier is going to want to come on the sheriff's tower, but it is possible. And the reason I say the sheriff's tower might not be very attractive is because when's the last time you had bad cell coverage right here in Paul Meyer? I mean, depending on which carrier, you've got pretty good coverage.
Could be somebody new coming in, too. Another.
There's only about four carriers. And okay. So
they're already.
Well, maybe, but it really depends on where they're at. It's just that it's very preliminary.
Yeah.
And I don't want anybody to count on that.
For example, we have two. Well, we actually have four carriers, three different carriers, but four carriers that are renting space on the Bremo Water Tower, which that money goes to FUSD, and we have two that comes into the county. It's AT&T and Singular, and they are both on the Palmyra Tower. So we do have two carriers that are in this area. I think it's Verizon and Singular that are on the water tower down there too. So and that revenue that we see that comes into the county is included in this amount of what, because this would be if we would build three additional sites and we would have revenue on three of them. Estimated over 10 years, we would be putting out only about a net of that amount.
So we're building them for how much?
Well, a new tower costs about $300,000 for the tower itself, and then we've estimated $100,000 to $150,000 for site development, for like the road and all that kind of thing. You would also have land acquisition or leasing or that kind of thing too. That would be, but we're and I'll show you some summaries on that.
And maintenance costs.
Maintenance costs is included in here.
I other surveys.
Buying the property.
Right.
Developing the site, putting the tower up. You know, $450,000 or $500,000. But then you own that perpetuity, you've got to maintain it, but you own it.
Sure.
So if somebody wants to put something on there, we get the rent from it, but you'd also be able to put your communications on there. Yeah.
Now, what I did here with this is I looked at how long, if we were going to build a tower instead of leasing this for this Kent Store site, using option one, you know, where that was all the stuff is on, all the equipment is on the tower, and option three is if we would light that tower. If we would build this tower, it would take us less than 4 years to recoup the money. And with option three of lighting and using leasing that lighted tower, it would take us 7 years. For the VFW, it would be 3.5 and 5.5 years. For the Cohasset one, option one, it would take us a year and a half, or almost less than 2 years, to break even. And option three, 3 years. If we do it as a receive only, it would be almost 5 years for recouping costs.
But you're talking roughly $2.7 million or whatever is what you're looking
at. I don't want to interrupt, but you do need to extend the meeting.
Oh, we need to a motion to extend the meeting. It's 8:04.
Madam Chair, I move to extend the meeting until midnight.
All right, it's been moved.
Please
we extend until midnight. Second?
Second.
All right, we have a motion by Mr. Weaven. Second.
Optimistic.
Second by Mr. O'Brien. All in favor? I know you're going to say aye. We will extend. Okay?
Ms. Okay. So what does staff recommend? I mean, we need your guidance on how to proceed because it really impacts how we negotiate with the tower owners and how we proceed because we need to have the sites nailed down in order to get the frequencies and we can't there it's kind of cart and horse a little bit and to be able to get the system in place next so that we can do coverage testing before the leaves fall off the middle of September is when we need to do that so then the whole system is in place in October November time frame all of the sites need to be in place by middle of summer, built and everything by the middle of summer. So we're trying that. That's why we're bringing it to you now, okay. As far as
is
explain.
This the option three
so
or four together.
This is what staff would recommend is that at the very least you strongly consider lighting the towers, and because it takes the antennas the big hog of space and puts it at the top where that is not space that is usable by anybody else other than us because public safety because we do not allow the towers to go any higher so that they're not lit. So at the very least, we would recommend that you allow for the towers to be lit. Or to consider a possibility of lighting the towers and building two additional sites. And we would recommend the VFW and the Cohasset areas that we consider having county towers. So that would mean that we would own three of our towers. And again, the BREMO Dominion one, we can lease and be on there at no charge. So we would essentially have these two leases, and with the towers being lit, we're using much less of the space, and then it gives the tower owner more space that they can sell.
Why would you not lease, why would you not want to buy or build, near Colcomb, which is running along 64, which would seem like you could maybe rent space on that?
That was just based on using that particular site because it's already been that tower is an improvement to what the tower that we currently have equipment on at the fire station, but if we were looking at a different nearby site that might actually be a good thing, especially with looking at Louisa is getting ready to build out their system and with the discussion about. The two systems interconnecting, having another tower closer to the border could be beneficial to both of us, which would mean they would help us with maintenance costs.
Now, the Cohasset one, you said they sold it.
Yes. It's been built, but there's nothing on it, and it was just recently sold.
Maybe have we approached them as combine that, or we have talking about building one somewhere in the same area?
We have asked, and they are not interested in selling at this point, but we haven't, I haven't asked.
No, we haven't made any formal offers through our attorney. This is part of what we need to get from you. And for instance, the VFW and Cohasset sites, I think, are nominally on the same elevation,
they
pretty close.
They should be, yeah.
Because the VFW one is still on top of the bluff, and the Cohasset one, what I'm wondering is if we can have the engineers look, maybe in between there, build a 300.
At the very least, the fact that we're considering building is going to strengthen our negotiating power, so
but I think that you're talking about paying back in 3 to 5 years. Generally, that's considered probably a good business deal. But I think for us to sit here right now, for me, and determine what the best deal is.
Oh,
you need far more information.
We've got lots more for you. Some we have to do in closed session because it's contractual and things. But we're not expecting a decision tonight. This is way too complicated
for
an hour briefing.
Yeah.
But you can see that we're going to need some real
but
hard
need option here, option here, soup. Option
well,
here. And
you've got them.
Yeah.
You know, we've been giving it to you. But we have to do more because there's a lot of complicated details to this. But we're going to need board direction as we move forward in this in the next 3 weeks or 4 weeks.
Well, and this, because I mean, hearing what you're saying about, okay, well, what if we're looking at, we need a site at the VFW and Cohasset. What if we would go taller in between or in that area? I mean, we haven't really talked about that, but that's an option. I can go back to the engineers and say, what if we would restructure this a little bit? What would that do to our coverage?
And that's another 2 years.
It would be
extra.
It would be helpful on this particular grid if you added in the number of towers.
An extra 2 years, in other words,
building.
It was 3 to 5 years, and 199. If you want to put that extra up there, it'd probably take another 2 years payments to pay for that.
No, what she's talking about is instead of using the VFW site and the Cohasset site, instead of building a new tower at each one of the sites, 195s. Potentially build one 250 or one 300 in between. So one tower instead of two towers.
Okay.
And it may cover that area. It just depends on the elevation.
Okay.
But we need to look at all this. But we need a couple of you probably to come to a meeting or two with our consultants and engineers to ask questions from your perspective. But in the next 30 days, the board's going to have to make decisions on stuff.
Yeah. Now, I know the 911 is important, and that's our first priority. But we also have a lot of pressure from the community on just regular using cell phones.
Right, right.
And we've been
broadband.
I got on the board
issues
8 years ago, and that was something that was really, we were meeting and had plans and all of that. And I don't think, maybe we need to bring forward, how have we improved? We may have improved, but the public don't know that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I can assure you, just in the 4 years I've been here, there's been vastly more antennas put up.
Yeah, and we I'm talking about
carriers on antennas.
I'm talking about improve the that people
coverage.
can receive it instead of going a mile up the road to use their cell phone.
Right.
We need to let them know that we have made some progress in that area, and hopefully with these particular towers, we'll get some providers on there that can help even more.
Yeah.
Let me present it this way. First of all, I'm meeting Friday with my staff to kind of put the genesis together for the broadband task force that I've been talking about, but we've got to get through this hump. That will then, one of the first things that will be done in that task force is a scan, environmental scan, to find out where we've been, where we are.
Yes.
Where we're going is a whole different ballgame. But it's hard to imagine too many carriers jumping up and saying, "Oh, county, you just built an antenna. I want to put something on there." When the Cohasset tower's been there and nobody's put anything on it.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not sure us building towers will necessarily get anybody else to put the cell up there. Well, how are you going to get them?
We're going to have to put some pressure on somebody's cell people.
Okay.
Well, and this chart gives an overview of the options. Again, the one is as it was originally designed with everything on the tower. Two is the possibilities of using some shorter antennas on a couple of them. Three is to light the towers, and it uses less space on the tower because it takes those big antennas on the top. Four is the possibility of building the sites, and then this is staff recommendation to do a combo of three and four.
And four has a total of four intent, four sites being built and three as?
Yes.
Four
and
three is?
And one of them is included in the contract, so it would be three additional.
None being built, four, except the sheriff's office. Three has none being built,
right.
Four has four being built. Three and four is a hybrid where you only build two out of the four.
Two out of the four.
Right. Now, with this...
So the tower construction for two towers is $1.35 million?
No, that's three.
That's three towers.
Three towers.
Right. Yes, that would be three.
Three
and then this is two.
We're running about 450,000 pieces, yes.
Okay.
So what we did here is we've been talking about lease costs all along, just leases, and then what we have budgeted is it's about $3,500. This is the annual cost for maintaining maintenance, and that's for fuel generator updates, the UPS battery maintenance, electricity to the sites, and that kind of thing. And this is actually going in the FY17 budget for it, because it's maintenance costs in there.
Well, we've got to figure out which one of these go in, when it started being paid for.
If you're leasing, you don't need to provide fuel and electricity.
Oh yes,
you do still.
Yes, because we actually pay for the lease areas. We lease the space on the tower, and it usually comes and the ground. You don't have two different fees.
The power
fees.
Comes down to our box,
right?
Utility box.
I see.
And then there's also a generator at each site and a 1,000-gallon fuel tank for each site.
Each carrier comes in and brings and puts a box in, essentially.
Yeah, so they have like a big H with all the electric boxes, electric things that come in on those.
Okay.
So then the way the lighting normally works is that the owner of the tower puts the lights on, pays to put the lights on, and pays the preferred way is to have them install them and maintain the lights. So there's no additional cost outright to the county. It's usually reflected in the lease amount,
right.
For them to recoup their capital. What I did in here was basically if we paid to put the lights on the tower and we paid to maintain it, so this would be the most that you would expect. So this lighting maintenance per month on these options here, this would go away, as would the lighting equipment, the one-time fees that would go, you know, if the tower owners paid for it here, we would not have to pay it. But if it's our towers, we would.
Mm-hmm.
So annual lease and operations, it gives you those figures.
The figures are there.
Okay.
You'll get
good.
A much more detailed dollar set of things that puts more level of detail. But you can see the various costs between them, and then the net annual cost and the 10-year cost. But it really depends on the permutations that you are willing to consider. Are you willing to consider a county-owned 250 or 300? Are you willing to consider putting lights on towers that aren't there now? Are you willing to consider building a tower when we've kind of let the industry build the towers? But in this case, it might be the way to go.
I think you can consider all of those and pick out the best.
I think so, too, except that that's not what the Planning Commission and the Board had talked about in the past. Everybody was a little anti-tower. And even when I was on the Planning Commission, people were not terribly excited about towers, and it was a stretch to allow people to build 195s.
It has
but
been
now ubiquitous, and it's part of our life. So.
Right.
Yeah. And as you notice here, I mean, if you're looking just at numbers, to build our towers, this actually puts us in the black.
Well, this is a rough ballpark front-end estimate.
Don't give us any.
But we were looking, my goal was to look at how can we be as cost neutral as possible, on those options too. So with hearing what you've said, we'll come back. I mean, you'll see more detail of what we've prepared with this presentation. But I'll also go back and talk with the engineers about if we would place a larger tower, could we do with less towers, and how would that all work?
Okay.
So
any
questions that's helpful.
For Ms. Elliott? Thank you for your knowledge. You've been working on 911 for how long? About a year?
Probably
2 years?
Yeah.
And
11 months.
Not too long.
But they're teasing me about that I'm a sponge.
Yeah,
so.
you're smart. You're picking up all that's wonderful.
All right, thank you.
Our consent agenda, Minutes of December the 16th, 2015, policies for the Board of Supervisors, proclamations and resolutions, grant for the new triad in the Commonwealth of Virginia, CRM fund requests, and fiscal year 16 school supplementary appropriation requests for Families Learning Together grant funds, open space contract application, and that was from the Hemmings, open space contract application for the Johnstons, rural rustic roads, Route 1102 Fayette Street. Anyone would like to pull anything from the consent agenda for further discussion?
I don't think I have anything on it.
Oh, my God.
Mr.
But you guys don't have a budget on here.
That's true.
Well, you know, anyone that Mr. Weaver knew he was not going to say anything about this and still continue the meeting till midnight?
Yeah, right. I'll find something.
Yeah.
Mr. Weaver, if there's an N and an O on it, you're always pulling.
Right.
Yeah.
I like the explanation between the proclamation, what's the different proclamation and resolution.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I thought that was very good.
So if we just don't have any policies about it, right, so I couldn't find it. So I researched all around the Commonwealth and pulled policies and created one.
Mm-hmm.
One just shows proclamations, and essentially those are honorariums.
Sure.
And then there's the format for it.
Right.
And then the resolutions are much more procedural and action-oriented, and there's the
rule of work. It gives us a better choice because we've turned down proclamations and people don't understand.
I don't think anybody really here needs it now, but the next person that comes in will need it. We need to have some kind of policy. So.
Right. Okay, may we have a motion for the consent agenda, please?
Madam Chair, I move to approve the consent agenda from G through MC that you have previously read.
All right, second. All right, the consent agenda was a motion by Mr. Weaver and second by Mr. O'Brien. All in favor?
Aye.
Anyone opposed? Chair votes aye. Do we have any unfinished business? Any new business? I will now open public comments number two. Please come to the mic, give your name, your address, and you have 5 minutes to speak to the board. Okay, Mr. Dorsey.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Chairperson, my name is Bob Dorsey. I live at 6 Dover Court at Lake Monticello. I was hoping Mr. Sheridan was going to be here tonight. I wanted to tell him how happy I was to see his health returning. I rise this evening to applaud the formation of the board and your interest in the proper order and procedure of the board business. I also applaud and encourage the spirit of cooperation displayed tonight between the members as you jointly seek the right path, the right way, and the right time for the county in all things. As reported in the press, but not yet confirmable in the public record as yet, the James River Water Authority recently met to consider their actions with respect to several issues. One of the actions moved was a vote to join Louisa County Board of Supervisors and the Louisa County Water Authority in a suit against this board and our citizens. The Louisa contingent voted unanimously to join the suit. The Havana contingent voted 1-4, 1 against, with 1 absent. The motion therefore carried on this one yay vote from the Fulana contingent, and the JRWA joined the suit challenging the actions of this board to hold the JRWA subject to Fulana planning and special use permit processes. Now, in preparing to speak to you tonight, I did a little bit of reading about the JRWA on their website and reviewed their minutes since their initial formation and organization. This is the second instance I could find of a non-unanimous vote since the formation of the JRWA. This is one generally harmonious and focused group. They seem to agree on almost everything, but not this time, though. Now, the Fulana members of this authority are there to represent the interests of Fulana citizens and to follow and implement the guidance of this board. Favana iVote did neither of these things unless this board would have its citizens believe that they gave guidance to this member to vote to sue themselves and the citizens of Favana County. It's pretty clear that this JRWA member voted in the best interests of JRWA without regard to those who appointed them nor those who they were appointed to serve. They cannot remain in appointed office and continue to be empowered by this board to do further damage to the interests of Favana citizens and ignore the guidance of the Favana Board of Supervisors. According to the JRWA governing documents, a JRWA representative can be removed at any time because they serve at the pleasure of you, this board. I call on the board to consider this matter and this individual's actions as a serious breach of the board's and the public's trust. I further request this board to remove the individual from the board immediately. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Dorsey. Anyone else would like to speak to the board? If not, I will close the second comment and we'll come back to the board. We're going into closed meeting, Mr. Weaver.
I assume we're going back in basically for the same thing.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, I move the Favana County Board of Supervisors enter into a closed meeting pursuant to the provisions of Section 2.2-3711A.6, Section 2.2-3711A.7 of the Code of Virginia 1950 as amended for the purpose of discussing investment of funds and legal matters.
All right, do we have a second?
Second.
All right, it's moved by Mr. Weaver and second by Mr. Bryant. All in favor?
Aye.
Anyone opposed? Chair votes aye. We are now in closed meeting.
Okay, there he is. I'll start reading.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I move the closed meeting be adjourned and the Favana County Board of Supervisors convene again in open session. Be it resolved to the Board of Supervisors does hereby certify that to the best of each member's knowledge, only public business matters lawfully exempted from open meeting requirements under Section 2.2-3711-1950 Virginia 1950 is amended, and only such public business matters as were identified in the motion by which the closed meeting was convened were heard, discussed, or considered in the meeting. A second and a recorded vote needed.
Okay, may I have a second?
Second.
All right, it's been moved by Mr. Weaver, second by Mr. Brown. To come
go.
Back in close, I mean in open session. And we have a motion.
To adjourn?
No. We need to make a motion.
You need to vote on
it. Oh, yes. You have that written out?
Yes. You need to vote on it.
We need to vote on an issue that we had in close session.
Roll call? Did we not do roll call? I thought we
did.
I'm sorry. O'Brien?
Aye.
Patricia?
Aye.
Okay. And the chair? Aye.
Okay.
All right. Now, we do have a motion.
So, Mr. Payne, could you summarize?
Yeah, but he's going to write that.
He's writing that.
He can tell you it is, and you can just say so.
Okay.
Let me say this. We have received a letter from an attorney representing the firm that represented the county in the Davenport case. That firm had contracted for an expert witness in the Davenport case, and the claim for his services passed through that firm. Now, they went to the county, and the county paid them directly to him. But what happened in this case was that this expert was the one who refused to give opinions at a critical juncture in that case, and his failure to give those opinions so damaged our case that was the reason we were obligated to go to settle it. We otherwise believed we had a strong case to go forward. So what had happened was he had been paid about round figures $59,000 for his services to date. He sent a bill for a little over $24,000 additional. We believe that he had not earned that because he failed to give the opinions that we expected him to give and didn't tell us about it. He sued the law firm in the General District Court of the City of Richmond. It was there were some preliminary motions specifically on the jurisdiction of the court because the real party in interest was the county. The court overruled those. We went to trial on, my memory is December the 16th, and the court ruled that, I'll just read this, the court declines to go beyond the terms of the agreement and finds that plaintiff has carried his burden of proof under the agreement as to the work done through September 23, 2014, but failed to communicate his change of perspective to defendant in a timely manner on the 24th. Consequently, the court enters judgment effective December 18, 2015, in favor of the plaintiff for $18,857.50, which is the amount invoiced less the time billed for September 24 and 25. That was the court's decision. And the claim from Mr. Harmon, that is the Andrew Park's attorney, is that we pay to Mr. Doty, the expert witness, the sum of $18,857.50, amount awarded by the court, and that we pay Mr. Park's attorney's fees in the amount of $8,844.18. Madam Chairman, I have these letters, and I'm going to submit these to the clerk for the record. It is my recommendation that, although I believe the defense was meritorious, it has been fully and fairly litigated, and that unless I think we are probably past the appeal period. We have noted an appeal. I don't think they have. Unless they have noted an appeal, my recommendation is that we recommend to Mr. Harmon that he dismiss the appeal, and we just simply terminate the matter once and for all.
Okay.
So I recommend that you accept the claim as stated.
All right. We make a motion to recommend.
So made to recommend the claim.
Second.
All
right. It's been moved by Mr. Weaver and second by Mr. O'Brien that we approve the recommendations coming from our attorney concerning these claims. All in favor?
Aye.
Anyone opposed? Chair votes aye. And at this time,
good riddance.
I would like to have a motion for us to adjourn.
So moved.
Second?
Second.
All right, it's moved by Mr. Weaver and second by Mrs. Eagle that we adjourn. All in favor?
Aye.
Anyone opposed? Chair says aye.
Those opposed can stay.
You are.